call to order the Minnesota House Committee on Criminal Public Safety, Criminal Justice Reform. This committee is being held under Rule 10.1 of Minnesota House Rules. You'll find that on the Minnesota House website. Basically, it allows for official committee meetings of the body to be held online via remote technology. Today's hearing is meant to be an informational hearing only. There will be no official action taken at this meeting. I'll say a little bit more about the meeting in a second. I'm going to ask the clerk to do a quick roll. Again, this is only an informational hearing. The only reason I'm doing the roll is to make sure that everyone here knows who else is in the room, in the online room. And so with that, the clerk will call out the names.
For sure. Mariani.
Here.
Edelson.
Here.
Johnson.
Present.
Christensen.
Here.
Considine.
Here.
Dean. Representative Dean.
Here.
Howard. Representative Howard. Lush.
Present.
Long.
Here.
Lucero.
Yes.
Miller. Representative Miller.
Representative Miller is, again, there's no official business, but he is excused. He did contact me, not being able to be here with us today.
Mueller.
Here.
Nash.
Same with Representative Nash. He also contacted me as well.
Novotny. Representative Novotny. O'Neill. Representative O'Neill. Oh, awesome. Pinto.
Present.
Poston.
Present.
Amazing. And then I'll just repeat Representative Novotny. Okay, thank you.
All right. Jason. There are a couple of members from the from my committee that are also here. This was a joint meeting.
Yes, I was about to move there. Chair Considine, perhaps you can call out their names.
Representative Tapke.
Here.
And I'm not sure if Representative Wolgemann got the notice. I think everybody else is a crossover between the two.
Very well. Welcome, Representative Tapke. Actually, this is a joint hearing, I believe, Representative Chair Considine.
Chair Mariani?
If not, we'll make it one. Representative Johnson.
Representative Novotny is in the waiting room. We've been waiting for a while to get in.
All right, let's make sure he gets in. Let's mark
his
presence. We'll mark him present, if the clerk could so do.
He's in the room now.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Novotny, we've registered your presence here. Members, we have a full agenda today. We will have a lot of testifiers. Brett will certainly be greatly appreciated, particular respect a little later in the agenda. It's part of our function as a legislative body is to provide oversight for the executive branch's work that we obviously legislate for and appropriate for. And so today's hearing is meant in the spirit of doing that oversight. As we, as the chair, became aware of several important developments over the course of the last couple of months relative to the accounts and the policies under our jurisdiction. The primary one, of course, many of you know by now, is the pending closing of the two prison facilities, the correctional facilities up north in Togo and Willow River. It's a pretty substantive announcement and one that certainly deserves public discussion, review, et cetera. However, there are other issues as well that this committee has spent time working on over the course of the last year, for sure, at the very least, in which it was important to do some updating in regards to things that we had hoped we would do, have done at the end of our regular session this year. And so there's a lot of updating that needs to happen. What I'm going to do is, because of the community impact relative to the two prisons, I'm going to do my very best to make sure that we spend at least half of our time having the discussion on that and hearing from perspectives on both of those facilities. But we will reserve that then toward the second half of the hearing. We would normally be scheduled to go to about 2:15, so we're using regular committee time frameworks. I am certainly willing to push this to 2:30, but I'm certainly in respect to the House's schedule and to everyone else's schedule, there is individuals that would like to hold to that as much as possible. So the agenda today will be to hear both the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections developments and impacts relative to budget, structural budget issues. In particular, many of you recall at our regular session that this committee pushed out a supplemental and deficiency funding bill that was subsequently passed off the floor of the House and unfortunately met no match in the Senate. As they failed to pass a supplemental and deficiency budget in a regular session. We went into special session, of course, a couple times this summer, and apparently there were some relatively healthy discussions about funding both supplemental and deficiency funding for Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections. However, there was no final agreement to that at that time. The House again, off the floor of the House, passed a supplemental dash deficiency funding for both Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections. I think that reflects well on the Minnesota House in terms of meeting our constitutional obligation to ensure for the public safety of Minnesota. Unfortunately, we were not met with corresponding action from the other body that allowed us to eventually take care of those needs. So today's conversations are going to involve what those unmet needs are and some of the consequences and outcomes as a result of that. My hope is that we will use this conversation as a way to continue to meet our obligation when we re-adjourn, when we come back together as a legislative body, perhaps in the special session that has not yet been called, but we anticipate will be called, and then, of course, in our regular budgeting cycle once the session is back to a normal reconvening in January of next year. So with that, members, we're going to start by having a quick walkthrough of a...
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, before we get started, I would just want to mention my disappointment with the information, the draft copy of the bill being sent out to my members 20 minutes before this meeting started, and I'm looking at the committee page website, this draft bill and the information on Togo that was letter is still not on the committee website. So people watching and have no idea what we're going to be talking about.
Very well. Your disappointment is noted. These documents will be online. If they aren't online, I have not gone online to take a look. As you'll hear in a second, the bill draft that we're walking through is pretty much the same bill that we passed in the regular session, and the items that we have been putting forward consistently during the course of the summer. So there won't be any surprises in this, but your disappointment is noted, and we'll make sure that all of the information, of course, is always publicly available. So the agenda will begin then with a walkthrough. It shouldn't take very long at all for the funding obligations that the chair certainly feels that we should continue forward as we have in the committee relative to supplemental and deficiency needs of both the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections. We're then going to move into a discussion of one of those supplemental items, which is the funding for the sexual assault examination kits. We'll move into a general discussion about the deficiency funding for the Department of Public Safety. There's a small deficiency related to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission that we also passed twice over the course of the last several months. And then we will move to the Department of Corrections discussion, beginning with the community supervision supplemental requests that were not finalized this year, even though, again, the House acted to take care of those needs. And then finally, discussion on the DLC overall proficiency with a focus on the prison facilities. So with that, I want to take just a few, this will be very quick minutes to call on nonpartisan House counsel to do a quick walkthrough of the supplemental slash deficiency funding House File XXX that the chair intends to introduce the next time the legislature convenes. And so with that, I guess it's time for our House staff.
Mr. Chair, this is John Walls from House Fiscal Staff. Did you want me to walk through the appropriations?
Yes, please, Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, the and members, the appropriations in this bill total about $31.4 million. There is some offsetting revenue savings in the governor's original request for some of the funding to do some additional supervision, which would bring the overall total down to a net figure of about $31 million. So, Mr. Chair and members, going to the bill and on line 1.13, we see the Department of Corrections. There's a total of $17.3 million in spending for corrections. Much of this is for corrections overtime and staffing and additional money needed to pay salaries for correctional officers. Of that amount, $7.4 million on line 1.18 go to the institutions area. And on line 2.3, we can also see the savings that would come from some additional investments in community services funding. This would include increased supervision at the DOC and also at the county level as well. Mr. Chair, the DOC maintains these savings cannot be recognized unless all of the investments are fully funded, and the savings would total on line 2.4, $2.469 million if those items were funded. Mr. Chair, I would also note all of these appropriations are in fiscal year 2021 as fiscal year 2020, and those requests have expired. So, Mr. Chair, going down on line 2.1 for community services, there's $9.3 million spent there. There are the investments in community supervision partners. $3.9 million in 2021 is added to the Community Corrections Act subsidy. $310,000 on line 2.8 is for county probation officer reimbursement, and on line 2.22, $430,000 is made available to the DOC to provide supervision to Meeker and Renville counties, and those are offset by revenue. Mr. Chair, on line 2.28, $422,000 is to increase officer or offender supervision by the Department of Corrections. On line 2.33, $2.6 million is appropriated to establish county and regional revocation intervention service centers. On line 3.5, $365,000 is for a cognitive behavioral treatment and community-based sex offender treatment and to increase housing alternatives. On line 3.12, there's $1.2 million for correctional overtime and staffing. And Mr. Chair, the final area on line 3.15 within the Department of Corrections is the operations support area, and their salary needs are $586,000. Mr. Chair, moving on to public safety on line 3.19, $4.482 million is requested to be appropriated. Of that amount, $3,096,000 is for the testing of sexual assault kits. And on line 4.1 is $1.386 million for staffing and operating costs at the lab for forensic testing. And Mr. Chair, on line 4.8, there's a $36,000 request by sentencing guidelines for a deficiency. However, we were notified by sentencing guidelines today that due to some savings they've realized, their request would only need to be $12,000. And Mr. Chair, that finishes all the appropriations within the proposed legislation.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Walsh, for that. This should be familiar to most, if not all of us. There are some items that are not here from the bill that we passed at the end of the regular session, but otherwise we're looking at the same purposes and the same expenses and savings and offsets as well. We're going to hear from the departments in a bit so they can explain any of these that any members wish to go over. We can entertain questions relative to this at that time. So with that, members, we're going to move to the sexual assault examination kit funding. And we have two testifiers, Ms. Lindsay Bryce, from NCASA, actually three, Ms. Lindsay Bryce and Jude Foster. And then we'll have Drew Evans, the BCA superintendent, who probably would be in a stronger position to answer any of the fiscal questions that you may have relative to the kit funding. And again, members, this funding was our intention on this committee in regular session. Again, we passed the bill that funded it. We took that action off the floor of the House as well, so the House's position has been clear. However, these kits are still not funded as a result of no agreement being reached by the Senate, who have not acted to fund these kits. So with that, Ms. Bryce, I take it you'll be our first person.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members, staff. First of all, I think there's a little confusion. Jude Foster is our statewide medical forensic policy program senior coordinator, and she's been before you in the past. She's actually not here with me today.
Okay, very well.
She's on vacation, which I fully support.
Good for her.
I'm Lindsay Bryce. I'm the law and policy director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You've heard from us a number of times. We provide leadership and resources for sexual assault programs and allies to prevent sexual violence while promoting a comprehensive, socially just response for all victims and survivors. Mincasa has spent more than a decade working towards comprehensive reform of medical forensic compliance in Minnesota. And I just want to be clear, this has been a bipartisan effort in both the House, the Senate, and through the governor's office. This just isn't a partisan issue. We're not interested in it being a partisan issue. Everyone knows someone who has been impacted by sexual assault. I would go so far as to say that every single person on this Zoom call knows someone who's been impacted by sexual assault, even if you don't know that you do. So there's some history that's important. In 2018, extensive efforts created a right for survivors to access information such as the date their sexual assault kit was sent to the lab, the date the agency received notice of the results, and whether a DNA profile was obtained. But that information has proven to be very difficult for victims to actually obtain. They have a right to it, but actually getting it has been very difficult. And in large part due to a lack of consensus around centralized storage, which is one of the issues that we're trying to deal with this year, that 2018 bill didn't create a tracking system or a retention period. So that's how we got to this place that we are right now. Just a couple caveats that the 2000 or context maybe 2018 legislation requires law enforcement and prosecution to document if they choose not to test a sexual assault kit, but that data isn't collected anywhere. And it isn't accessible. So it's not, unless Minnesota chooses to test all sexual assault kits, a tracking system that collects that data becomes really important to understanding those decisions and understanding why some kits are tested and why and others aren't. And I'm just going to stop myself here for a second to make sure everyone understands the difference between a restricted kit and an unrestricted kit, because that's also critical in understanding why this is all really important. With a restricted kit, the victim survivor has not given consent that kit be released for testing. So we end up in a situation where there's a question about where and how long it should be stored for. Should it be sitting at the hospital? And what does that look like? What's the space look like that it's sitting in at the hospital? Ramsey County County Attorney's Office worked to help purchase a locked refrigerator to solve, to fix at least temporarily this issue in that community at that hospital. Or should those restricted kits be sitting in law enforcement, where they aren't attached to an ICR necessarily, they're not attached to a report? That gets complicated. An unrestricted kit is a kit where the victim has released, they've signed off, and they've released that kit for testing. And when victims sign that release, they assume, and I would argue they should be able to assume that kit is actually going to be tested, that evidence is actually going to be looked at and evaluated, to determine how it fits within the reported case. So the legislation, this year's legislation has a couple different pieces. I'm not going to belabor them. I think we've talked about the detail of that legislation quite a bit. It's centralized storage and tracking. It's centralized storage at the BCA and a tracking system that victim survivors can access so they can get that information about what's going on with their kit. Which is what the 2018 legislation promised them. It's testing all sexual assault kits that sends a, let me back up, testing all unrestricted sexual assault kits. So all the kits that somebody has signed off on and said, yes, I want this tested, I want to move forward. That sends a powerful message to survivors, and I would argue offenders also. It also complies with federal best practices, and that's important. And then the other piece is a uniform consent form that really standardizes the information provided to victims across the state. Right now, that sort of standardization is particularly critical because of COVID-19. Advocates are not able to meet victims at the hospital like they have in many communities. I'm not going to say all because I think it's happening in a few communities, but in many or most communities, advocates can't meet a victim survivor at the hospital where they are going through a forensic medical exam like was usual and common and standard pre-COVID. There's just not that access. So advocates are providing that support and information remotely, which just it's harder. It's harder and more complicated, and there's, you know, things are, it's harder to explain things that way, and there's just a lot of concern that things get missed. So I've had a lot of people ask me, why now? Why are we continuing to try to do this now during a special session in the middle of a pandemic and all of the other challenges of 2020? And I would say that sexual assault care reform is both a public safety and a criminal justice systems reform. It's really both. It's not one or the other. It's fair to say that victims and the public expect and deserve that a thorough investigation and prosecution of criminal sexual conduct. I think it's also important to recognize that Minnesota choosing to test all unrestricted sexual assault kits eliminates a point of bias in the system. It eliminates a place where somebody has to look at a victim survivor story and say, does this make sense for me to be testing this or not? So if we're simply saying we're going to test all of them and use that evidence as part of our decision making, that's looking at the evidence and then making a decision instead of listening to a story and making a decision, if that makes sense. Testing that evidence is just critical. It can corroborate a victim's story. It can also exonerate suspects. So there's a whole variety of reasons it's really important to test these kits. Another reason I think it's important to do now is that we know that the 2018 language is incomplete. There's this confusion about who stores kits. Do hospitals store restricted kits? Does law enforcement? How long? It's different in every, you know, it's really community specific right now. It happens differently depending on where you are in Minnesota. And that's just not how our system is supposed to work. Without standardized storage and tracking, victims are often unable to get the information they're entitled to under the 2018 legislation. Now that we understand all of those issues, why wouldn't we want to fix the language that causes confusion and a lack of clarity? I would also say that we have some evidence that communities save money by testing these kits and prosecuting offenders. I can provide the links to this. I think we've provided this actually in some prior documents when I testified previously. But there's evidence and studies out of Cleveland, Ohio, and out of Kentucky demonstrating that there's an economic benefit to testing sexual assault kits, and that it really is most cost effective to test all of those kits. In the Ohio case, they tested over 7,000, and these are backlog cases. So these are older cases, but they tested over 7,000 and did a complete investigation, prosecuted cases, and their study indicates that they saved the county $38 million. So there's some level of evidence that in other communities that this actually saves communities money to do this on the front end. COVID-19, that's the other reason I would say why now. COVID-19 has made everything more complicated, harder, and less accessible. And I would say that's across the board. We're hearing that from victim survivors. We're hearing that from advocates. Everything is harder. Everything takes longer. Everything's more complicated. I talked about how advocates are rarely able to meet victims at the hospital. We're hearing from folks who are fearful about contacting law enforcement. We're hearing from advocates that victims are, you know, anecdotally at least, victims are not coming forward until their situation is so bad that they can't do anything else. All of the things, and then all of the other things that are making COVID makes difficult also impact survivors. Then we have systems that were never really set up to support survivors are stressed. Every community is doing things differently. Processes are changing constantly. I mean, I think about the court systems and those processes. It's hard to keep up, even as a lawyer who engages with those systems, it's hard to keep up on what's going on. Virtual court can be more or less accessible depending, but it's definitely more complicated. It's taking longer to hear back from parts of the system. Everything's kind of slower. And then finally, numbers. People, I've gotten a lot of questions about what our numbers look like. And I would say that it depends. We have some member programs who have numbers that are up dramatically. We have some member programs that have numbers that are down dramatically. And that's shifted as Minnesota has been more or less open or accessible to folks. But what we do know is that people have less access to just about everything right now. Young people don't have as much access to teachers, for example. So you may not see the same level of mandated reporting happening in certain scenarios because you don't have kids in, you know, kids aren't really interacting with adults outside their household in that kind of way. I think that's similarly with, there's a similar analysis with college students. They may not be out of the home on a campus able to access resources in a way that's different from being in their home. So all of these things are impacting how survivors are moving through this. So in conclusion, I'd like to thank the House for continuing to push this reform forward. We really appreciate the support and for inviting us over and over and over to talk about this. I would like to know why the Senate has not moved forward on this. We've heard clear messages of support from the Senate. We had a hearing actually scheduled the week that the legislature moved to working from home due to COVID-19. That's never been rescheduled. And we really need, victim survivors need the Senate to take action. We appreciate the governor's support. We've had a lot of support from the governor as well. And just to be clear, we've heard support messages of support from all three, House, the Senate, and the governor. But victim survivors need to see action. And so we're hoping to move past messages of support and into actually acting and working together to pass sexual assault kit reform during September's special session. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Price, for a very thorough walkthrough of some pretty big and sometimes complex interactive issues here. We certainly have had, I think, tremendous momentum going forward to modernize our policies to make sure that there is justice for victims of sexual assault. And I don't believe there's anyone in the room who believes that because we're in the middle of a COVID pandemic that becomes any less acute. I think what I'm hearing from your testimony is, in fact, it actually makes it more acute, that there are new challenges before us. I do want to move forward with Superintendent Evans relative to this issue. I have to say this is really a good catch-up. I really appreciate it, Ms. Price. Because one of the thoughts I had is, well, wait a minute, I thought we had taken care of all the policy issues relative to this. And it sounds like that's still not the case, that we have a number of policy issues. We have big issues here relative to centralizing, tracking, retention, those issues that we had hoped would be taken care of by good funding, with BCA being the holder of the exams. Unfortunately, then we've not been able to get there. So with that, I'm going to ask Superintendent Evans if you can come forward and offer some information and insights relative to the kits and to the funding that BCA would need to be able to fulfill what we have so far in terms of our expectation of policy with centralizing and having these kits tested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, I'd just like to thank your committee for continuing to consider this really important issue. And while our financial impact or financial outlook for the state of Minnesota has changed in the times of COVID, the important work associated with this type of work with our victims across Minnesota does not stop. And so I really appreciate you continuing to consider this. As you know, this was in the governor's supplemental budget and continues to be an area that he very much supports because of the importance of this work. Sexual assault examination kits are often some of the most important evidence in a sexual assault criminal investigation. And so the testing of those kits becomes very paramount to ensure that we are eliminating bias and discretion in the decision-making process so that an investigator really has a complete picture of all the evidence available to him with this test-all approach. It ensures that all kits are treated equally across the state, regardless of the jurisdiction that's investigating it, by putting into place this requirement that we test these kits, and so that we can assure our victim survivors across Minnesota that their kit is being examined for evidence and that that evidence is then shared with the law enforcement that's investigating it. By funding this proposal, it would allow us to ensure that we quickly identify perpetrators of these crimes wherever they occur across Minnesota, but also quickly clear the innocent and make sure that we get answers in the investigations within a reasonable period of time. We know that better case outcomes are there for our victim survivors when investigations proceed quickly and they have the evidence analyzed quickly so that they're able to move that case through the criminal justice process, whatever direction it may go, as quickly and expeditiously as possible. The storage of all restricted kits, and Lindsay did a great job of walking through the difference between the two kits, and I should be clear about that test all approach is all the unrestricted kits, but that storage of all restricted kits is really important too. What we've seen through this work with partners like MnCASA, the hospital associations, all the law enforcement associations, is that there's wide variance across the state of Minnesota for the amount of time that restricted kits are held and how they're held within hospitals or law enforcement jurisdictions across Minnesota. Creating the centralized storage location at the BCA will ensure that through that period of time, should that victim survivor come forward and choose to convert their kit to be tested, that we will have it at a location that will be readily available, and we can assure that it will not be destroyed within the period set by you as the legislature. Software tracking, that's also part of this, the third prong of this three-piece approach, would ensure additional accountability throughout our system. And that accountability comes by creating a web portal where all the different personnel or persons within the system, from the victim survivor to the law enforcement, to the SANE nurses, to the criminal justice professionals, to the county attorneys, would have insight into the exact status of that kit wherever it is in the system. Knowing that status breeds accountability by having people say they can look in, whether it's the victim to survivor who believes that kit is at law enforcement, as the MnCASA with Lindsay Bryce just explained to you, they'd be able to make a call. It might be an oversight by law enforcement. It may be somebody not following the law. It'll ensure that multiple people are knowing exactly where that is at the system, because often, as she had noted in her testimony, it can be difficult for people to get information in the system along the way. And that's not necessarily through anybody not providing information. It's sometimes not knowing the right question to ask. And so it's providing a portal where people can go in on their own time, their own volition, and see exactly where that is, so we can do that through the system. And it will give us metrics to really understand through this process exactly the value some of these kits are providing us in the system from start to finish, from the entry into the criminal justice system through the back end. And so this proposal would provide the staffing, equipment, and training and the necessary and supplies to do that test all for unrestricted kits approach. It would provide storage capacity at the BCA headquarters location for all restricted kits for the period of time needed for retention. And then that kit tracking that would give that direct portal for all the persons that contact that particular case as it moves through the criminal justice system. And so we really do believe at the BCA, this is a really important process going forward. This test all approach would provide the capacity at the BCA to create a specialized unit that would focus on these types of examinations within our DNA laboratory that has significant capacity, but this would provide that specialized approach so that we really can focus on these types of cases to provide the best outcomes for victim survivors across Minnesota. And with that, I will take any questions.
Very well. Superintendent Evans, I'll ask a pretty basic duh question, but I take it that the department does not have the resources without the appropriation in order to do the requirement of the activities that you and Ms. Price just identified.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for that question. I'll just give you an example. We had a 42% increase in DNA requests from this time, from the mid-year point of 2019 to the mid-year point of 2020, and that encompasses all crimes. And so this additional requirement without the without the additional resources to do this would provide additional strain on that DNA section that handles these cases, meaning we do not have the capacity to do this without greatly impacting our homicides, our assaults across Minnesota, all the different violent crime. It would mean that we would go even further. And the current turnaround time right now for our DNA laboratory is sitting at 63 days. Our goal is always our goal at the midpoint of 2020 is 63 days. Our goal is 30 days in that laboratory to get results all quickly so we can solve these cases across Minnesota. And so it would be very difficult for us to implement this without creating greater harm to all the other cases in Minnesota.
Very well. You know, this is probably a good transition to the commissioner, but I do notice that Representative O'Neill raised her hand, so I want to call on her really quickly. And Representative Johnson, your hand is up, and I'm thinking that was from the prior because I've seen it from but you let me know in a second. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to do my video because my connection is out in rural Minnesota and it's not very good right now. Thank you. My question is for Superintendent Evans. As he and I work through this bill over a few years now, and with Ms. Bryce as well, with Mincasa, something came to light also since I did the legislation back a couple years ago that that we've been talking about also, and that is the connection to the serial rapist and also the profile of what a serial rapist, who he selects as his victim. And there's maybe a misconception of that. And I was just wondering if you could, especially Superintendent Evans, if you could speak to what our conversations were about in drafting this legislation, specifically about what you've discovered about rapists that rape more than one person, and how, if we test all and that information is in CODIS, how does that impact that? If you could just address that, thank you.
And Superintendent Evans, if you can be brief, that would be greatly appreciated.
I will. Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for your continuing interest in this topic and work on this. You've taken a great interest in moving a lot of different policy pieces forward. What she's referring to is that this test-all approach is that one of the things that we've discovered is if an individual commits a crime in multiple jurisdictions and, for example, becomes a issue of consent and that they can't prove one way or another that the victim indicates in the process that they were raped by the individual and the individual says they had sexual contact with that person, but it was consensual. And our investigation cannot discover one way or another exactly what we're doing, enough evidence to move forward with prosecution, that sometimes those prosecutions wouldn't move forward. This process, by testing all, if that individual does that same thing in multiple jurisdictions, it will be tied together because that profile will be uploaded into our state DNA index system and ultimately the combined DNA index system at the FBI, and that we will connect those cases through that DNA analysis. And so it becomes very important to tie across different jurisdictions, especially in states like ours and across state lines. We have over 420 some law enforcement agencies in Minnesota, and it will be a way that we can quickly connect those cases across jurisdictions if that individual is traveling across the state using this as their MO to commit these types of rapes.
Very well. And of course, as I asked earlier, Representative, or rather Superintendent Evans, this does take resources. And I know you've got the capacity in the department, but there are a number of other major crimes that you're working awfully hard in applying your lab expertise to. And so something has got to give unless we step forward and meet our obligation to this very good policy. So my hope, members, is hopefully we will be in special session. Hopefully we'll have a chance to move this bill. My hope is that every single member of this committee will support this bill. That was not the case the last time around. It was certainly my hope that if we really care about it the way we're all saying that we do, we're going to have to walk our talk and make sure that these services are well resourced. With that, I'm going to move on to the commissioner, Commissioner Harrington, to speak about the deficiency funding before we slide over to the next stage of this hearing. So is the commissioner with us here today?
Yes, I am, sir.
Very well. Welcome to the committee. Tell us about the deficiency and why it's vital, what's important, what's happening, what do we got to be doing?
All right. Thank you very much, Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm John Harrington. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I also share Drew's thanks for continuing the discussion on this budget pressures of the department. I think it's important for us to have this conversation because, frankly, the budget pressures that you started out discussing in the last session and into the special session haven't remained stagnant. They have in fact gotten worse. And while many things have stayed the same, the pressures we're seeing in terms of crime and victimization and draws on the department all have increased during that period. As you know, the Department of Public Safety has been playing a leading role in the state's response to COVID as we coordinate all of our work out of the Homeland Security Emergency Management Center with Director Joe Kelly, and we've been actively involved in that. We also were actively involved with you and members of your committee on the police reforms this summer, and we were quite happy, as I've been able to report, on how much further the state of Minnesota is ahead in terms of legislative work, and now the work of implementation now starts, and much of that work does still rest with the Department of Public Safety. And so while we're happy that we were able to get the bills through, I recognize that now I've got more work to do as we set up training and regulation and reforms there. One of the unfortunate side effects of that I have to talk about is the state and the Twin Cities are both currently experiencing increases in both violent and property crimes. 2019, Minnesota recorded a 4.7, almost a 5% increase in Part 1 crimes, which are the most serious crimes reported to the FBI. Violent crimes, including murder, robbery, and aggravated assault, all increased over their 2018 totals. One area that did drop was human trafficking cases, but before folks say, well, that was a good thing, I want you to know that what we know is that human trafficking cases are largely dependent on funding to task forces that pay attention to those and set up task forces. And unlike years prior, where we had the Super Bowl or the Final Four, which prompted departments to set up the task forces, what we've seen is less task forces, and therefore we've seen less numbers in human trafficking cases. But I really do not have any sense that we have less victims of human trafficking or less women that are being trafficked at this point. Property crimes, including burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and arson, increased over 5%. 117,000 property crimes reported in 2019. That's 8,000 more than the preceding year. The two areas that jumped the most were arson and motor vehicle theft. They jumped 8% and 13% respectively. And I will say that from what we can tell from the early reports and the daily reports we get from local police departments, we're not seeing a diminution in either violent crime or property crime this year. One area that I'm particularly concerned about is violence against women. I was really appreciative of the fact that you started this conversation out with sexual assaults, but domestic violence is also increasing, and the conversations we're having with Violence Free Minnesota and SPIP and DAP and others is that COVID has made reporting of domestic violence to local authorities even more problematic, and even reporting it to doctors has become challenging as women are now having virtual digital visits with their doctor, which oftentimes means that their abuser is still in the room with them and they're not able to make those reports. We saw in just the last few days a murder in Bloomington that ended up in a barricaded suspect and multiple people shot. That was, in fact, a domestic homicide also. One other area that I think is important to note is that we're seeing the rates of bias crimes also increase. We had 146 bias crimes in 2019. That's 19 more than we had in 2018. And one of the things that's alarming to me is that 49 of the 2019 cases were crimes committed upon or directed at Black or African Americans. That's almost three times the next most frequent group in terms of those bias crimes reporting. So as I mentioned, that all of these crime trends do have an impact, and one of the impacts is very definitely on the state patrol. At the midpoint, I think Drew mentioned already that the DNA laboratory is seeing a 42% increase over the same period as the year before. One of the issues that we have to look at is the legalization of CBD, which was passed in 2019. Unfortunately, costs for the laboratory were not funded, and so we are seeing the impact of the legislation being passed, but we do not have the funding to be able to deal with it, and that's having an impact on the lab. Turnaround time for DNA, for example, which is now becoming one of those things that prosecutors really almost always ask for. We're now up to 66 days turnaround time in 2020. That's up 13 days from where it was in 2019. And keep in mind that we say that at the same time that courts have been shut down due to COVID. And so we've actually had less court cases. When the courts reopen fully, we are going to be buried in cases that have already been processed, where the DNA scientists will have to be on the stand testifying in those cases. And that's going to even more dramatically decrease or increase the lag time there. We've seen an increase in crime scene responses linked to violent crime. Just recently in the last few weekend, we had 200 hours of overtime related to multiple crime scenes. And they're all over the state. And that's part of the challenge. In Long Prairie and Cannon Falls and Badness Heights and Burnsville and Bloomington, we respond to all of them. Unless a department like Minneapolis or St. Paul, which has their own lab, is the primary response agency. But as you know, we also are the primary response agency for all the officer-involved shootings. And those also have been all over greater Minnesota and all over the Twin Cities. And so we have been tied up working on those. I want to thank you for your time today. I think it's these are an important question about what are we doing and how do we get move forward with this, whether it's VAWA issues, violent crime issues, the lab or CBD, they all funnel back to our ability to help people get justice. And justice oftentimes means providing evidence in court. Sometimes that evidence excludes somebody and identifies them as not the suspect and frees them and exonerates them from a case. And in some cases, it is holding the right person accountable for the crimes that they've committed. At this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. The number of issues you raised, but one I just want to highlight very quickly for the public and for my colleagues on the committee, and that has to do with the CBD testing. That was not on the radar, you know, a year and a half ago. It is now, as a result of action that the legislature took. Quite frankly, members, that a number of our colleagues took without talking with this committee. You know, terrific that, you know, CBD is now, you know, regulated because it should be. However, there is cost to that, and the cost comes out of our lab work that have been committed and dedicated to doing other vitally important things. It seems to me that some kind of a tax or a fee for that activity is an appropriate thing for us to be doing. It's certainly one of my intentions to pursue that. I'm just speaking of myself as an individual legislator, but you know, these things, when we're not regularly paying attention to public safety, this is the kind of, you know, unintended consequences that can happen. Commissioner, you're absolutely right. There's never no time to not advance or support public safety. And my hope is that when we reconvene, that this committee does what it has been doing for a year and a half, which is to stand with our public safety department to make sure that you have the resources to meet the challenges that are out there. My hope is that every one of our members will adopt that posture and that we'll move forward with a successful effort this time to make sure that we're funding the very least of deficiencies, if not some of the supplemental needs of the department. Representative O'Neill, I see that you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarifying question for the commissioner. When you're talking about CBD testing, are you talking about the growers, the hemp growers that have to have their CBD, or excuse me, the hemp tested? And I know the processors have to have theirs tested because there's already a pretty high application fee. It's over $400 to the Department of Ag to cover the costs in processing that and other things as well. When you're a hemp grower, I happen to know that because I'm growing hemp. So I know that there are already large fees collected through the Department of Ag. And I'm wondering what exactly is it that you are testing and who's paying for that, since the Department of Ag is collecting a very large fee now.
Representative, I'm going to ask Superintendent Evans is online and he's far more familiar with what we're doing in testing. So I'd like to ask him to answer that question for me.
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Mariani and Representative O'Neill, that's a really good question. We were involved with the hemp legislation and providing some guidance on that. I agree with you that that's regulated well, and that's done through their process. What the commissioner is referring to in this is that it's become a defense in cases that typically when we were getting a suspected marijuana case into our laboratory from a law enforcement seizure, that it, we tested and we basically looked for some basic things and say whether or not THC is present and whether or not it's a leafy material, and that we look under a microscope. Because CBD and with hemp being online, it creates a position that we need to determine whether or not and show that it's over 0.3% Delta 9 THC based on dry weight. So what that means is that we need to quantify the percentage of THC in there if that is a defense in the case. And so we've been hearing from a number of county attorneys around the state saying they won't charge out large, large seizures into the state because they're saying they're hemp or something else. And we need to be able to test at our level at the state crime laboratory to testify in court that it's above that. And what that has meant is we've been in the process and we've already spent a ton of internal time and energy validating technology in order to determine what that process will look like going forward. So in other words, it's a new testing technique that we need to be able to prove in court that something is marijuana or it is CBD or hemp.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Okay, so I also happen to know that if you are a hemp farmer and you are growing hemp, unless you are part of the pilot project for the state of Minnesota, it doesn't matter if it is actually hemp in a 0.03 THC level or lower, you are illegally growing marijuana. That is the law. So I'm still kind of confused as to how can they claim that they're growing hemp when, in fact, if they're not in the program, they're already breaking the law, regardless of the THC level? So are we talking about something else? Because if you're not in the program through the Department of Ag, the pilot program, you already are considered growing marijuana and the full force of law should be impacted. So I'm still kind of confused as to the answer back.
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Mariani, Representative O'Neill, it's a good question. And we're really not talking about the hemp farmers. We're talking about individuals that are caught with these items. And CBD is even a clearer example that an individual be caught with something that is wax or oil that's actually THC, a concentrated oil, and they're alleging that it's not actually concentrated THC oil, it's CBD oil. And so then it is upon us as the government to prove that that item is in fact that THC oil. Currently, we do not quantify the level of THC in those items. And so that's what this is to move forward. And so it's not really aimed at the farmers. I completely agree with you. And when we worked on the legislation, they have the documentation they need. That's an affirmative defense for them. This is really about other individuals caught. And they're saying that the items they're caught with are hemp or CBD, for example. And we need to prove that it is THC, in fact.
At a very real cost that incurs. With that, members, thank you, Superintendent, and thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to move quickly over to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I believe we have Mr. Nate Reitz, who's the Executive Director, to speak about the small deficiency funding that they are still facing. Mr. Reitz, I apologize. I think it's Reitz. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nate Reitz, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. In this role, I serve the 11 members of the Commission, and I supervise the Commission's paid staff of 6 public employees, which includes myself. As I reported to your committee in February, Mr. Chair, and I was just reflecting that in my 40 years of living in Minnesota, this may be the first year I've nostalgically looked back on February. But as I reported back then, personnel compensation costs have historically made up about 90% of our agency's budget. So unexpected changes to compensation do have a major impact on our ability to operate. I also reported how these compensation costs are beyond this agency's control. We literally have the same number of people in exactly the same positions that we had in 2012. No new positions have been added and nobody's been promoted to a higher position. We had previously reported that our appropriated funds would be insufficient to permit us to meet our statutory contractual and payroll obligations in both fiscal year 2020 and fiscal year 2021. But thanks to one of our employees' temporary redeployment to the Minnesota Department of Health for 21 working days back in May and June, doing contact tracing for COVID-19, we made it through FY20 without reducing the hours of MSGC staff. And with respect to FY21, I now estimate that we will require a deficiency of appropriation of $12,000, which is lower than the number previously reported, in order to comply with our legal and contractual obligations and to pay for staff compensation for the entire fiscal year. While this smaller number is good news, the bad news is that without this appropriation, we will be required to reduce paid hours for a period of time, likely toward the end of the fiscal year. While I have made no plans regarding what exactly reduced paid hours will look like, I envision the possibility of turning off the lights, shuttering our doors, and ceasing to review statewide sentencing worksheets, ceasing to provide live support for sentencing guidelines practitioners statewide, and pausing our support for the ongoing sentencing policy work of the commission itself, again, for a brief period of time, possibly toward the end of the fiscal year. This is a bare-bones requirement, this $12,000. It does not include additional expenses for items that would enable us to accomplish our mission better, such as legal research tools and employee training and development that we are not legally or contractually obligated to pay. It also does not account for the additional expense of reimbursing the unemployment insurance account for reductions in hours that will be necessary if we do not receive this deficiency appropriation. Mr. Chair, subject to your questions, that concludes my comments.
Very well. Very small, efficient, and yet important function of state government and costs that are not being driven by adding staff or, you know, pursuing all sorts of new things that you could be doing, but just really meeting your obligations. You know, it seems to me that I know we're only talking about the rest of this fiscal year, but it seems to me that you got, I hate to put it this way, but quote unquote, a little lucky with, you know, the staffer being redeployed temporarily for vitally important work. That's not how we like to be able to balance our state budgets, is depending on that kind of luck. But it seems to me that you may be looking at a bigger issue in the next biennium. I know we're not talking about that today, but it seems to me that unless we're addressing this issue proactively, you're going to probably consistently face that kind of challenge.
I'm not going to disagree with you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Okay. Well, thank you. And again, you know, we did include the deficiency funding in the prior iterations of this committee's work, and it's certainly my intention to put that before the committee action when we reconvene in the legislative session. Thank you, Mr. Reitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, we're going to move slide over to the first part of the discussion of the Department of Corrections, and we're going to begin with a discussion on community supervision funding. And with that, we do have representatives of MACPO and MACAC to speak with us today, Jim Schneider and Midge Christensen. Mr. Schneider, I've got you first.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Jim Schneider. I'm the Director of Probation in Cass County and the current president of the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, commonly known as CBO. We appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to update the committee on the work that is occurring in field services. The inclusion of our organization demonstrates to the state of Minnesota the importance of our work and the supervision of probation, parole, and pretrial services. Excuse me, clients. We want to recognize the leadership of Commissioner of Corrections Paul Schnell as the Department of Corrections navigates the current COVID-19 situation. Our partnership, not only with the DLC, but with stakeholders from the legislature, Community Corrections Act counties, and nonprofit organizations is equally important to the safety of our communities. We appreciate the supplemental funding bill that was passed out of the committee earlier this year. Your actions solidified the work being completed by probation officers. You also set the stage for the coming year on the importance of funding field services. As the population in jails and prisons decline, this committee understands the importance of probation officers supervising people in our communities. Probation officers continue to deliver evidence-based practices, many of which can be labor-intensive. Getting folks to engage in the change process requires time. It also recognizes the balance of accountability, incarceration, and treatment. Caseload sizes are inconsistent across the state and are most driven by funding. Some committee members may recall the reform that took place back with Human Services years back. One of the outcomes resulted in limiting caseload sizes for child protection workers. There is no such restriction in probation. Our CPO system takes responsibility for the local needs of our criminal justice system, even at times when caseload exceeds a reasonable level. As managers in our business, we exhaust our current workforce as we inundate them with caseload sizes that are too large while still expecting a reduction in recidivism. This too will come at a cost. That cost is a reduction in public safety. As you know, counties are currently involved in the budgeting process for the coming year. Counties know the financial restraints we are under locally, in the state, and nationally. We need your assistance to meet your financial obligations to us and to the citizens of Minnesota and their safety. Field service delivery systems will be meeting in the coming weeks with the Council of State Government. It is our hope these conversations can produce fruitful results on solutions to fund field services. This is a critical time for the criminal justice system and field services. We cannot afford to fail. Thank you for your time and consideration. And Mr. Chairman, if I will take any questions, if there are any.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Thank you for the work of your members across your association. I'm going to do this. I want to call on Ms. Christensen to speak, and then I'll stop at that point to see if there are any questions or comments for both you and for Ms. Christensen. Ms. Christensen.
Yes, thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you to the committee for entertaining remarks from field supervision again. I know that you have focused quite a bit on learning the ins and outs of the business that we do. There's been a high level of concentration throughout the past legislative session on two key items in the criminal justice system: criminal justice reform, obviously, and also criminal justice funding. Countless hours have been spent in hearings, taking testimony, engaging in discussion and debate from both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. And I know I personally consistently hear the same desired outcomes as I'm sure you all do, and the same expectations from the criminal justice system from people in every role and every walk of life, regardless of their relationship to the system, or if they don't have a relationship to the criminal justice system, or their party affiliation. And those three things are: they want safety for all Minnesotans in all ways, they want a fair and compassionate system that's free from disparities, and they want a comprehensive, individualized approach to justice, not a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter model. And that approach needs to have the capacity to meaningfully engage victims and work with clients in the communities in order to effectively intervene to reduce criminal behavior. As Jim just mentioned, that takes time. It takes time to build that relationship with clients. It takes time to work with our criminal justice partners. Funding for one function or piece of the system at the expense of another will not achieve any of those outcomes, because this is truly a criminal justice system. So when you're hearing from the BCA talk about the rape testing kits for purposes of DNA, corrections agents collect DNA from offenders and submit that to the database to help with prosecution and tracking in criminal cases. You heard Nate Reitz talk about sentencing guidelines. Corrections agents are the ones that are completing those guidelines, completing the pre-sentence investigations to move those cases through court. And then obviously we're the ones that do the supervision or supervised release on the back end of the system as well. So the majority of the criminal justice functions rely in varying degrees upon work performed by corrections agents in field supervision. For those individuals that find themselves in a position to interact with a supervision agent, whether it's a victim, it's a stakeholder, it's a BCA agent, it's a client, it's a community member, they all want the same thing. They want a competent, skilled, knowledgeable individual assigned to their case that has an adequate amount of time to devote to their needs, whatever that may be. Failure to fund the community supervision system And the deficiency that exists for all three delivery systems is going to directly impact that work. The capacity of the supervision departments and our agents to effectively perform all of those different roles I mentioned is directly tied to the funding, and it's absolutely critical to this state. We did not receive in field services on the county side, we did not receive any base operational funding last year in the budget. So this supplemental budget is extremely important to us. And it's important that we meet this funding request for all areas of the state as a whole, no matter what system your local entity happens to be involved in. The best way I can describe that, and I know it's confusing, but if you look at the medical system in Minnesota, here in my small town of Montevideo, my city and my county have joined together and they run the hospital system. If you live in the metro, you might go to Alina or Fairview or North Memorial. That's simply the provider. You're still just looking for a doctor because you're in a car accident, right? You need that service. So with the corrections delivery system, I provide it at the county level in my area, but the Department of Corrections provides it in a different area. It's just the model. We do the same thing, we're the same agents, we're doing the same work. So in summary, it's the collective work of all of those agents in all areas of the state as a whole that really needs to be adequately funded and equitably funded in order to achieve the outcomes and expectations that are shared by everyone and that everyone around the state is entitled to. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. It has impressed me for quite a while that this strong partnership is the way I think of it with the state and our county-based services is one of the smartest ways for us to advance public safety. The work of our locals to be able to step up and provide that kind of relevant on-the-ground relationship building, pathways for corrections, for individuals, means that, among other things, the state can then also heavily focus on those really big threats to our public safety. So I'm really appreciative of the work that you do. My hope is that we can, again, push forward appropriate funding for our local folks. We do have a question from Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is to both Mr. Schneider and Ms. Christensen. So if you don't have the resources to do what I would think would be the job that you're tasked with, whether it's pre-sentence investigation or whether it's back-end supervision of individuals while they're on probation, when you don't have the resource, something has to suffer. Where are you making those hard decisions right now about what you have to do without? And are you evaluating those individuals on probation and supervision? Are you trying to determine who are the individuals that are at more of a risk if they don't have as regular check-ins as they probably should have? Are you looking at things relative to drug addiction and chemical dependency and alcohol abuse? I mean, if you could just briefly tell us where you're cutting the corners to make sure that you can still do your job.
I'll start with you, Ms. Christensen, and then I'll turn over to Mr. Schneider.
That's a good question, Representative Dean. It's kind of a mix of all of those things. In my agency, we already cut one full-time equivalent agent position last year already. And so that means that we had about 180 offenders that had to be reassigned with our existing number of corrections agents from 11.5 FTEs down to 10.5 FTEs. Obviously, I'm a small agency. If you are Commissioner Schnell with the Department of Corrections, you're looking at a much larger number of clients. Hennepin County is looking at a staggering amount of potential cut to their budget. And so it is an amount of redistributing the workload. It is, as you said, looking at risk. So we do that based on who is coming up, low risk and low need, that we can give even less different type of supervision to, so that we still concentrate on those high end clients who have high needs and high risk, because they're the ones that really need those intensive interventions delivered. But the other thing that it does, honestly, Representative Dean, is that these things that, as I said, you've already heard from other individuals from, DNA collection, sentencing guidelines work, pre-sentence investigations, those get pushed out further and further. And the attention is not given that they need to make good individualized decisions or to collect that data for the court. Some of our members in MACAC, Scott County, for instance, they've got enormous lag times in getting pre-sentence investigations completed because they just don't have the bodies to do them and supervise the caseload that is assigned to them as well. So it's a combination of those things. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Jim to weigh in as well.
Very well, Mr. Schneider.
Chairman Mariani, Representative Dean, you know, I would echo that. It comes down to personnel. Our system, quite frankly, is broken into three areas: low, moderate, and high-risk people. We know that low-risk people, we leave alone, they self-correct themselves. Moderate-risk people are the most movable people we could have in our system, and those are the ones that we can impact the most. And so when we don't spend the time working with moderate-risk folks, then their change process doesn't occur. And then recidivism goes up. In Cass County, we measure recidivism by rearrest, because that's one thing that we know that affects the entire criminal justice system, is the arrest and getting folks back in. Addiction is the biggest driver of our behavior, and the biggest driver of our business. So when we're focusing on meeting the needs of people, we're trying to match them with the services that they need. And then my last point is that when people are in this movable stage and the stages of change, if we don't take advantage of that, they never move on and they never get the treatment that they need. And then when they don't get the treatment they need, we know that the behavior comes out sideways, and usually that's involvement with the criminal justice system.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Schneider, and thank you, Ms. Christensen. Thank you for your work. Thank
Chair
you.
Mariani, I have another quick follow-up.
Oh, Representative Dean, please.
So as I think about your response and my question, I think about, one of the big concerns, after all, this is a committee that deals with public safety. And it seems like this lack of funding to allow you to do the job is actually putting at risk some issues around public safety, and I'm not going to point the finger at you for not doing your job well, but, you know, as you just mentioned, Mr. Schneider, there's those individuals that are moderate, in the moderate range, that are the highest correctable individuals, and the individuals who are might be likely to recidivate. And, you know, if this funding is not met in the near future, would you say the impact on public safety could be, you know, a bit more of a challenge than it currently is?
Representative Dean, Chairman, absolutely, I would agree with that.
Christensen, I see you're nodding as well.
Yes.
Very well. So doing a good smart thing right now, Representative Dean, it sounds like a much more effective, efficient thing for us to be doing.
Hopefully thank you, we'll Mr. do that Chair.
Again. Very well. We're going to move forward then with the DLC deficiency funding, and the big focus here will be discussion related to the pending prison closures. And so I'm going to start with welcoming Commissioner of Corrections, Commissioner Boschian.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity. Again, for the record, my name is Paul Schnell, and I serve as the Commissioner of Corrections. I know my time is really limited. I just want to piggyback a little bit on the supervision question. And I think Mitch Christensen really talked about this notion of a system. And I think when we think about public safety in its broadest sense, whether it's the State Patrol or the BCA or victim services or corrections. These are the core elements of public safety in our state. And I think it is critical from a practice standpoint and for the good of the people that ultimately all of us serve, that we have first good policy that governs that, and second, that that those systems are adequately resourced. So given this, I want to just start out by saying that I want to respond to a letter that I received from Representative Johnson O'Neill. The letter really was related to the announcement of the closures of MCF Togo and Willow River, the state's two men's challenge incarceration program sites. I want to start out by saying that the closures of these two facilities stem directly from deficiency, the budget deficiency existing in the DOC. The deficiency results from really Senate inaction on the agency's supplemental budget request. And the decision to close these facilities was, I would say, probably at the top of the list for the most difficult decisions I've ever had to make in my career. Not only did we have to make the decision to close these facilities, but really two facilities that achieve really exceptional outcomes. In addition to the six questions presented by Representative Johnson and Neal, the letter says, and I quote, "Well, we appreciate the difficult decisions that must be made during the time when the state of Minnesota is facing a budget shortfall due to COVID-19 pandemic and Governor Walz's executive orders. The solution seems counterintuitive to common sense." Before addressing the questions directly, I would just like to address the proposition of a correlation between the executive orders and the agency's budget shortfall. The DOC's budget deficiency was well known by the members of this committee, and I'm grateful to all of you for engaging in the conversation about the DOC's supplemental budget needs and bringing this matter to a vote on the floor. Unfortunately, we never, in the Senate, we never had an opportunity for a hearing, nor was there a vote on the DOC's supplemental budget request. Let me be clear that my preference would have been that the agency receive the supplemental budget it requested so that we could continue the good work that the agency does, and I'm talking about across our system. And within our agency, there would not be the impact on the people whose jobs are going to be impacted, or even the regional impact that the closures will have. It is really difficult, and over the last several weeks, I've had the chance to do so, to look in the eyes of those who have been being impacted by this, the impact on, as I said, the region, and really the impact on the outcomes that these facilities achieve. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that in my visits, I also talked to men being served by the programs, and they themselves lifted up the fact that these programs they felt was essential. I should point out that in addition to the supplemental budget request, both Togo and Willow River were included in the governor's capital bonding request at $2.6 million and $1.7 million, respectively. Sewer system at Togo and a radio system, emergency radio system upgrade at Willow River. Members, our request was not simply to address the deficiency. We actually proposed investments in the underlying infrastructure in these facilities. I would say I take seriously my responsibility in this role. I would also point out that Minnesota has a law that makes it a misdemeanor for an agency head to have expenditures beyond the legislative appropriation. So while it's certainly fair to ask questions about what informed the decisions about the closure of Willow River and Togo, the question of common sense is really a better question about responsible public stewardship of public resources, when from an agency perspective, few viable options exist other than the draconian measures that we unfortunately are required to implement. So let me address these questions. Why Willow River? And I'm gonna do this very quickly, and as questions come up, you can certainly ask when we're done, when the chair is ready for that. As mentioned, the closure of Toga and Willow River was one of a range of really bad options that we faced. We considered the full range, which I'll highlight in a bit. Simply put, we considered options that would help us achieve the required savings and have the least impact on bed space. Also, we weighed in our analysis the effectiveness of CIP, the cost of program delivery, and the needs of the facilities and the agency's ability to carry out our statutory and mission functions. We believe that when fully implemented, the closure of Willow River and Togo will yield a savings of approximately $10 million annually or $20 million over a biennium. The average per diem for an adult incarceration in the Minnesota Department of Corrections today is $104.96. To provide some context, the per diem at Oak Park Heights, the state's highest security level facility that includes a medical infirmary and residential mental health unit and hemodialysis unit, is $226.34 per day. By comparison, the per diem at Togo, the smallest men's facility, with no economy of scale, is $230.81. We know that CIP is a higher cost, but as has been pointed out, effectiveness is what has caused us to support the continuation of the program. And for the record, the per diem at Willow River is $139.89 a day. What other options to reduce spending did we consider? As mentioned, we considered a range of options, and specifically, we explored cutting one large facility. While such an action would help us quickly realize the level of savings we're seeking, but it would also come with a significant bed space impact. For example, MCF Lionel Lakes has a maximum capacity of 1,300 beds and an annual budget of $35 million, operates with 335 FTEs. In addition to the different services offered by the state's correctional facilities, the bed space loss, while minimally manageable today in a COVID environment, is not sustainable. We know that the court cases are backed up because of COVID. We also spent considerable time studying cuts across the agency. First, you should know that we made decisions at the outset. We made decisions that we would not impact county pass-through funding or community supervision. Some of these have been historical methods of meeting budgetary needs of the agency. The state's probation and supervised release agents are critically needed in community, as community supervision serves directly to community and public safety in communities across our state. Given the OLA report findings, we could not cut security in our correctional facilities, meaning that across the agency cuts are simply unrealistic. I refer to this option as the death by a thousand cuts example. For example, the scenario would be that we would cut 30 case managers, cut 20 higher level supervisors or management level personnel in central office or other units around the DOC, and we would need to cut 70 or so substance use disorder treatment personnel. When complete, this personnel cut of 120 personnel would yield about $12 million in cuts. The remaining cuts of $2.5 to $3 million we would have to achieve through other administrative cuts and or attempts to renegotiate purchase of service contracts. The problem with that across the board option is that we have already challenging caseload sizes in prisons, both in treatment as well as case management, are exacerbated. CD's treatment services would be further deferred to post-release. The cost of chemical dependency treatment then would be deferred to Minnesota counties and DHS on a post-release basis, which simply does not make sense. And I want to point this out as an example. This is past Tuesday, and this is heartbreaking. Just this past Tuesday, a woman got released from our correctional facility in Shakopee, young woman, 26 years old. Very unfortunately there for a very short period of time and was not able to access treatment. And she was released on Tuesday and was found dead by her mom as a result of an overdose on Thursday. Those types of situations, I think, can happen more if we're not mindful of the fact that we need to deliver these services across the board. And that includes the really excellent services that are being provided in treatment at Togo and Willow River. Other question was, the overall prison inmate census is down 22% since you took over as commissioner. Have you looked at closing a wing at some of the larger prisons, which could potentially save money without laying off correctional officers? First, the only the impact of correctional officers is really a result of the closure of facilities. We're not trying to cut correctional officers because, as I said, security in the facilities becomes so important. But the short answer is yes, we have looked at closing units. But closing a minimum custody facility on the campus of another facility or closing a wing within a larger correctional facility will not result in the needed savings. Secondly, in light of COVID, we must take all reasonable steps to manage risk of the introduction and the spread of virus in the facilities. So closing the units simply is going to pack people in closer together. How many staff at central office have been added since you took over as commissioner was a question. While I will delineate those positions added since I've been appointed commissioner, I think it's also important that we make sure that we understand the reason for those positions. The net additions to central office are as follows: one assistant commissioner, one tribal liaison, three FTEs to staff the newly created Office of Professional Accountability, two peer support staff, one government and community relations staff person. Additionally, a number of personnel were hired on a temporary unclassified roles, generally assigned to grant-funded positions. We also added staff to carry out JDAI, which came directly from a specific legislative appropriation. How many FTEs will be reduced from central office as part of your response to the budget shortfall? I would just say that we will, even with the closures of Togo and Willow River, should they come about, we will not make the number if we do not make additional cuts. So to date, we have cut 10 management or other high-level positions at central office. None of the cuts that we've implemented to date, nor that are on the horizon, are easy. In the coming weeks, I will announce additional cuts and changes within central office to help meet our budget. And I should add that right now, the DOC's executive team is working on changes to the organizational structure. These discussions are required to manage the workload, oversight, and responsibilities of the management level positions that have been or are being considered for reduction. In addition, we believe that the organizational structure changes will reduce our silos, improve communications, and align work by service area, and advance, at the end of the day, organizational performance. Chair and members, I want to thank you for your attention to the Department of Corrections and its one small piece of a large cog in a system that really is focused on the safety of Minnesota. I would also add that it, at this time, while it's unrelated directly to the criminal justice system, as you know, our colleagues on the DHS side and direct care and treatment are having conversations about the budget challenges they face. And I point this out only because I think when we start to think about what happens in cuts to mental health, or mental health service provision, I think we have to begin to think about what the implications of that will be to the criminal justice system, because historically what has happened is when the mental health system does not meet the needs of people, ultimately they end up in the criminal justice system, which is a horrible tragedy. With that, Chair, I would stand to question for any questions when you're ready to entertain them.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for walking us through some of the big decision points that the department had to consider toward this painful decision. We do have one question, but here's what I want to do. I do want to get testimony in, so I'm going to wrap all this testimony up first, and then we'll come back. I know we're going to push beyond our committee time, but this is important, and I'm willing to hang in here as long as as members are willing to do that as well. But Representative Polston, I'll put you at the top of that when we get to some questions and comments. I also do want to acknowledge Itasca County Commissioner Ben DiNucci, who has joined us. And my understanding is, Commissioner, you've got some pressing meetings and work that you need to also attend to. And so I want to bump you up and get you up right away here so you can offer your testimony. And I welcome you and thank you for coming to the hearing. So with that, if we can get Commissioner DiNucci, pull him up here, that would be terrific.
Thank you, Representative and community members. Hello, my name is Ben DiNucci. I'm the chairman of the board of Itasca County Commissioners. My district is home to MCF Togo. I would like to give you our perspective. From March 16, 2020 through July 13, 2020, Itasca County workers filed 6,416 new initial applications for unemployment. These new applications represent 28.7% of the county's civilian labor force. Large anchor employers temporarily ceased operations and laid off 525 employees at Blandon UPM Paper Mill in Grand Rapids and Keetac Taconite Mining Facility in Keewatin. An international company with a manufacturing facility in Big Fork, Minnesota, E2IP Technologies, announced on May 13th that location will be closed and permanently dislocate 59 employees currently working in advanced manufacturing sectors. This is a direct result of the coronavirus pandemic, the company's decision to consolidate its operations to headquarters in Canada. The county has also experienced economic adjustment problems as coal-powered electricity generation is being phased out. The Clay Boswell coal-fired power plant in Cohasset permanently decommissioned two units in December 2018 and permanently eliminated 57 jobs at the plant. An economic impact analysis conducted by the University of Minnesota estimated another 47 indirect job losses as a result. In addition, there is continued pressure to decommission the rest of the plant with a tremendous impact on workforce and tax capacity. Itasca County's 24-month unemployment rate went from 1.94 percentage points higher than the national average in February 2020 to 2.61 percentage points higher than the national average through May 2020. Four of the county's critical industries were among the five industries with the largest negative change in employment in the months of March, April, and May of 2020. It includes leisure, hospitality, retail trade, mining, and logging. Itasca County relies heavily on timber, taconite, and tourism. MCF Togo represents critical, family-sustaining, union positions in rural Minnesota that are outside our core industries. They are the best example of diversifying our rural economy to sustain through economic downturn. What's unique to this area, community members, is that these are the good jobs in our area. There is no going across the street when these jobs leave and getting employed at Target Corporation. When these jobs are gone, it adds to the list I've already read to you. So in addition, data from the Department of Corrections shows that people in the Challenge Incarceration Program reoffended a 32% lower rate than other offenders with similar criminal factors. Also, their chances for reincarceration for a new crime drops by 35%. An effective program such as this should not be cut. If anything, a successful and unique program such as this should be invested in and expanded. Correctional officers know that these results can't be recreated inside the fence. For these reasons, I strongly oppose the closure of MCF Togo and Willow River. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to testify first so that I can join our county board meeting, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you for your leadership. You're part of the state, and you're facing some pretty tough challenges up there. I just want you to know that this committee, we didn't know 3-4 months ago what kind of outcomes would happen if we didn't do the supplemental and deficiency funding, but we kind of figured it wouldn't be good. And so We worked awfully hard to push out a good funding bill. It was one of the last bills that we got off for the House in regular session. Then, of course, we came back to it in the first special session. There really is no reason. I mean, I understand the state budget, but what you're also talking about is that there's all sorts of costs that someone is going to take, so that someone's going to bear. And your community having to bear that by itself is just unconscionable. And so we will continue to push forward, at least this chair will, to make sure that we're properly funding our DLC and our DPS as well. Thank you for being with us here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Very well. With that, members, we're going to move back to the original list. And so I have Tiffany McComas, who is a Togo Correctional Facility Clinical Program Therapist. Ms. McComas.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tiffany McComas, and I work at MCF Togo as a clinical program therapist in the Substance Use Disorder Department, formerly known as Chemical Dependency. I'm here representing MAPE employees at the Willow and Togo facilities. I have worked as a licensed alcohol drug counselor for over 10 years for the state of Minnesota, with most of the time at CIP. Prior to transferring up to MCF Togo, I worked at MCF Willow River, and prior to that, I worked at the DHS Care Treatment Center in Wilmer, Minnesota. Working at CIP, I have helped offenders open up about past trauma, learn to cope with their cravings and triggers, and gain insight in how they have affected not only their victims, but the greater communities at large. Although treatment at CFP, our friends are challenging their unhealthy thinking, working towards making a positive transition back home. Treatment centers outside the Department of Corrections often have less time with clients due to the need for the therapist to cover a wide range of duties, as well as their clients not having the opportunity to stay in treatment as long. The ability of my department to focus on their substance use problem areas is because other staff at CFP provide necessary resources to ready them for re-entry. This equals greater likelihood of success for all involved. The closure caused by the lesser not funding department deficiency request affects me personally, as well as my husband, who also works at MCF Togo. We have a new baby and have recently purchased a home. My husband has worked for the DOC for 26 years, but is not close to retirement age. This closure will cause us to possibly have to work at two different locations far from home. The closest facilities that will have openings are at least 3 hours away. Finding new daycare and new positions, new jobs, and a new place to live are just a few of the obstacles in front of us. This means less time being a family and being financially unstable, to say the least. This closure will affect our small community economically due to 60 people losing unemployment, affect our region due to the loss of community service work provided by our offenders, and affect the state's future in a negative way. The news of moving CIP to another facility has already negatively impacted the offenders. They have concerns about not being able to complete treatment here and finish at a large facility. They don't believe that the environment they are currently in can be replicated inside the walls, and I have to agree. The staff who work here are invested in helping the offenders be successful, and the people we serve know it. The recent decision of a closure due to the lack of funding by legislature at Togo and Wilbur will have dire effects on the people that rely on these programs, the staff that run them, and the surrounding communities. I humbly ask that you please support me, the staff that work here, and their work we do to serve Minnesota. and pass the deficiency funding request. I want to thank you, the representatives that supported this program and the representatives that authored and co-authored HF 24 and HF 28 in the third special session. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. McComas. I am humbled by your testimony, and I want to thank you for your service to our state. I'm wondering, how long have you been in your clinical therapy position at Togo?
I've been Togo since 2013, so I wasn't even there for a year, and I was on vacation the first time they told me that I might not have a job in the next year. So this is the second time I'm going through this.
Okay. So 17 years in this latest, or rather 7 years of service. And your pathway to clinical therapy work, I take it that was a bit of a journey as well. You're a local resident, I suspect. You were accessing post-secondary somewhere nearby to get there?
Actually, I didn't even know where Togo was. I'm from the North Shore.
Okay.
So someone told me that would be a great place to intern. So I actually ended up at Togo to intern, and then my first job was at Wilmer. And I really liked how the CFP program was, because it really helps guys where they live in a kind of a chaotic lifestyle prior to coming to prison, and then they come to CFP and it goes to the other extreme, so they can find that balance in the middle. And so that's why I transferred into to MCF Willow River. And the reason why I moved up back up to Togo is that's where my significant other lived.
Okay.
So yeah. I'm a transplant.
Okay. Well, a well-serving transplant. You know, we have a letter from an Arlene Duff, who is a program director at MCF Togo. She had sent that to us earlier, so it'll be part of the record, as well as your testimony. Arlene works with Substance Use Disorders Program, and she very eloquently talked about, how the lives of individuals get impacted pretty early from alcohol and drug use, frankly, as children, and that leads to high-risk behavior that as adults lands them inside the system. However, that she's part of a kind of work that you're part of, it sounds like, in this case, focusing on cognitive behavioral therapy to produce effective interventions to help them put their lives together and break the cycles of trauma that they've been a part of. And so she, like you, is also calling for funding for the CIP programs and for Togo as well. But I just wanted, for the record, to get that out right now, but that letter will be part of our record as well. Thank you. If you can stick around, there'll be some question and answering a little bit later, but I want to get through all the other testimony as well.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to move to Tim Danger from Moose Lake for Correctional Facility.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and committee members.
Good afternoon.
My name is Tim Danger. I've worked for 15 years as a correctional officer. I am president of the AsMe Local 3887. And 3887 represents Togo and Willow River and Moose Lake. As a president of my local, I serve as the AsMe Council 5, Corrections Policy Committee, and the local e-board, and elected by the union members of the correctional facilities. I'm here today with colleagues from those facilities who will speak in a moment. Before we speak, I want to make my position as an AsMe Correction Policy Committee very clear. We support the legislatures passing the deficiency funding for the Department of Corrections, and the legislators must provide conditions with the funding so that Togo, Willow River, and all correctional facilities remain open and operating. The last time the legislator increased funding for the Department of Corrections, safety of the correctional officers was touted widely as a primary reason for doing so. However, when the department went to spending that money, our safety was not always the focus. Since that money was appropriated, we've seen increased spendings on TVs, desks for wardens. We've seen additional lawyers of management added, captains, assistant wardens, lieutenants, and program directors have skyrocketed without the correlation increasing in correctional officers. We've seen spending on the Office of Professionalism or Accountability, and we've seen spending from an unfunded mandated for omniscient office, an office that we haven't had or needed since 2003. So again, I want to make this abundantly clear. Passing the funding is not enough. You must pass it with conditions. It must be used to keep Togo, Willow River, and all facilities open and operating. We need the legislatures to have great oversight to help increase transparency within the department. These major decisions to close facilities, restructure the department, and significantly change the delivery of the program and services should not be made without legislative involvement. They should not be made without the use of us at the table. Use your power and now to halt these rash decisions until full legislation deliberates until next budget year. That's my short stint. I would like to turn it over to Officer Matt Stone up at Togo.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Danger. As Officer Stone, I do have you next on the list as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members and members of the community that are taking time out today to listen to this important issue. To remove the prison from the offender, you must first remove the offender from the prison. My name is Sergeant Matt Stone, and I've served the state of Minnesota for the last 8 years, but I've been serving Minnesotans for almost two decades. I used to be a canoe guide for an organization called Wilderness Inquiry. With WI, I taught guys with Down syndrome how to fish. I loaded wheelchairs into Voyager boats. I helped guys with TBIs roast a marshmallow, and I taught the J-stroke to able-bodied citizens that just wanted to learn something new. I was part of leading 40-plus kids from 20 different countries down a river, and I helped a senior class celebrate milestones with paddles. I was also a licensed foster care home in Sherburne County. There, I had 11 kids, white, Native American, African American, it didn't matter. They all lived safely under my roof. I also worked with a program run through St. Cloud State University that took inner city kids out to farms to show them where their food came from, as well as taking them walks through the woods to show them the natural surroundings. Both guiding and foster care have something in common. Removing somebody from what they know, it gives them the space to learn. It gives them a chance to grow, a chance to experience something outside of their comfort zone while knowing they're safe. Our offenders, they know the sounds and the smells and the sights of prison. They know prison so much that they're often uncomfortable being outside of them. This is why the locations of CIP are so critical. We ask them to step out of their comfort zone, and we let them know that their physical and emotional safety are important. We do this in an environment that allows them to exhale out what they know and to breathe in something new. But most of you listening to this already know, that's why you have cabins up north, away from the smells and the sounds and the sights of your daily life. Our small rural communities also offer a better chance for restorative justice. There is a real need up here, not just for the work crews that CIP offer, but it also allows the men to understand the true joy of giving back. In our barracks, I have a wall lined with letters of thanks from all of our surrounding communities. This all happens in an area where the men don't have to worry about who might see them. This all happens where they can smell fresh air, and it happens where the sights are different from those who can see them, change. This is where they go from being offenders to men again. To remove the prison from the offender, you first have to move the offender from the prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Stone. Quite taken by your description of what it takes to for folks to rediscover their humanity. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have Heather Hansen from Togo as well. Officer Hansen, welcome.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Heather Hansen, and for the last 6 years, I've worked at MCF Togo as a corrections officer. This budget problem is not your fault, but I'm concerned that if MCF Togo shuts down, the effect locally will be devastating. The state of Minnesota takes care of us with good wages and benefits. And in turn, we choose to use our earnings to support local small businesses. We are volunteer firefighters and first responders. We're rural and we take care of each other. I wonder if our small businesses, schools, daycare centers, and volunteer-run fire departments can withstand the loss of support by our 60 employees and their families. One of the most impactful parts of CIP, according to the men who come to Togo, is restorative justice. The men go out and work in our community, then come back and talk about how rewarded they feel. They talk about the lessons learned and the self-worth gained. They talk about how they can take what they learned from working in our community to their own communities. to your community, Mr. Chair. The Grand Mound burial site, located near International Falls, comprises five sacred burial mounds, ancient villages, and sturgeon fishing sites developed approximately 2,000 years ago. The men work incredibly hard to maintain the grounds, and they learn from the indigenous people the significance of the area. Who will maintain Grand Mound if Togo closes? Access North's ramp project provides ramps for the homes of people with disabilities. This project often means the difference in a person's ability to live at home or in an institution. Institutional living is something that the men at Togo know a lot about, and they feel so proud to contribute to the independence of someone they will never meet. Who will build those ramps if Togo closes? We work with small towns and townships like Bearville, Big Fork, Cook, Marcel, and Morcom. Our crews care for cemeteries, shovel access to fire hydrants, and paint curbs, mow lawns, rake leaves, and clean up after storms. With a combined population of less than 1,400 people spread across 218 square miles, I wonder who will do all that work if Togo closes. CAP cares for and provides firewood to 13 of our state parks and campgrounds. The DNR sells the firewood to the people who vacation here, the very people who understand the value of letting nature heal the soul. Can the DNR afford to keep these healing spaces open if Togo closes? This budget problem is not your fault, but if you fail to provide a solution, the devastating, far-reaching community impact will be. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Hanson, and thank you for helping to fill in for a number of us who are not from your corner, your part of the state, the community presence of this facility in this community. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we have Trevor Weston from Willow River, Officer Trevor Weston. Want to make sure I'm not frozen here. If staff can let me know whether I'm frozen or not.
We can hear you and we can see you.
Okay.
You're not frozen.
Okay. Representative Hanson froze on my screen, so that's what concerned me. Do we know whether Officer Weston...
Hanson froze on his screen, so that's what concerned him. We're probably going to freeze.
Chair Mariani, this is Jamel Lundy, the committee manager. I just want to note that Mr. Weston is calling in. I believe he needs to dial star six. If you
all right. I'm going to shut this down. I'm not getting it.
Chair Mariani, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Is this Officer Weston?
Yeah, Sergeant Weston, sir. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the committee and ladies and gentlemen for listening to me.
Yes, thank you, Officer.
I've worked with the Department of Corrections for the last 25 years, sir. I started my career at Togo. I worked with juveniles until approximately 2002 when CIP took over the women up at Togo. I worked with that program up until 2009, at which point I transferred over to MCF Willow River. About a month ago, my lieutenant called me on my day off and let me know the commissioner had decided to close MCF Willow River and MCF Togo. My heart just about stopped. There were so many emotions, I was absolutely dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it, and there was virtually no information anyone could tell me about how we were going to do this whole thing. It was an amazing moment. Even today, we have little information. We don't know when we'll close, who will lose their jobs, or how people will meet their ends. It's been an emotional roller coaster for myself and others. I worry about my peers more than myself, as I happen to be towards the end of my career. I worry about how they'll pick up, move to another community, find a new job, maintain an income and how it will affect their children when they start a new school where they don't know anyone. I wonder if they'll be able to sell their homes with the current economic situation. The stress people have been subjected to has been immense, and yet, with the intent to do the right thing, they return to work each day, performing in a professional manner, helping others change their thoughts, fulfilling their duties for the citizens of this state and the offenders they're helping to change. It's my privilege and honor to serve with them, and yet it is painful to hear the stress and suffering each of them are under coming to work every day, knowing that at this point their job is going to end. Last night I went to bed, and I laid there for a little bit and finally got up realizing sleep was not coming because I knew today I was going to testify before your committee. Thinking about how things have affected my coworkers, thinking about the handshake I received from an officer just yesterday when he told me, Sergeant Weston, I bid out. I had to make a decision for my family. And so while he loved working down at Willow River, he chose to go back to Moose Lake in order to maintain some stability within his family. It did, and it does sadden me. These are good people who are in a solid living. They give back to the community in so many ways, economically by spending their wages. Additionally, as was previously noted, they're also your volunteer firefighters, your coaches, your community activists. They're not just numbers. They're not just pawns on a board. Since this announcement, one other group has suffered, and that's the offenders. They wonder if they'll be allowed to complete the program. Those who are coming into the system are wondering if they will get a chance to attend CIP at all. Over the years, I've received many phone calls from offenders who graduated this program. They call back, they tell me, hey, we're doing a great job out here, sir. I appreciate what you've done. I have letters from offenders who have graduated saying thank you. I actually got a letter from an offender just this morning thanking me, and he left about 9 o'clock. Closing MCF Willow River and MCF Toga is a terrible decision. While I empathize with the budget issue, I think the decision to close us is short-sighted. The program cannot be replicated at other sites with the level of consistency and professionalism and experience that this staff and these two facilities have. We've been doing this for a great number of years. And the only way you get really good at something is by practicing. And we've been practicing since the early 90s. The data behind the challenge incarceration program bears out its value to the state. There was a study in 2008 that was able to demonstrate that CIP reduced rearrests and reconvictions by 32%. It also reduced reincarnation for a new felony offense by 35%. CIP helps to avoid costs to the tune of approximately $1.8 million annually, or $4,600 per participant through recidivism, victim costs, lost productivity, and costs associated with criminal justice. Our communities, our staff, citizens, and offenders need this program to continue where it is. This is the combination that works. I would like to say that the dollar figure that I just threw out, I don't believe is even close to accurate, because when we get an offender down here, we teach them new beliefs, new values, ethics, morals, and behaviors, which helps them become a productive member of society and a contributor to our community. But I think even bigger than that is the fact that he goes home, he teaches his children, his neighbors, his nephews, the same things that we've taught him, and we break that trend of dad goes to prison, junior goes to prison, and then grandson goes to prison. And I've seen all that over the last 25 years. It's just not going to work without CIP and the rest of the department doing their part. You can't replicate this program by moving it inside the wire. It will never be the same, and it will never be as consistent or as successful. Thank you for your time. I'm relying on your determination to do the right thing for the staff, citizens, and offenders of this state, that you will save this and Togo facility. Thank you, Sir Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you, Officer Weston. Thank you for sharing some very, seems to be very deep, learned common sense and wisdom about redemption and what it takes for our correction systems to be part of helping people become whole. I was very taken by your observation that there is a cycle that could be broken here. And so you're aware that you're working not just with the individual in front of you, but with the next generation as well. Thank you, Officer.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you. Sarah Stone is next on the list. And do we know whether we have her in the waiting room? I don't see her name on the Zoom list, but I do see a couple numbers. And let me check with my staff to make sure I'm not frozen.
We can hear you, Chair.
All right. Here. Okay. Give it a minute.
Unmute. Hello, hello.
Hello, I hear a voice, yes.
Oh, so I might be on Jill's number, sign-in number, so forgive me. So sometimes it's not, sometimes the people that are sent aren't necessarily the best equipped people, but sometimes if you just show up, you can make a difference. So that's me today.
All
so
right.
I'm here to reiterate a lot of things that have already been said, but I will make a point to say that the state of Minnesota owes all the people of Minnesota, the good citizens, the bad citizens, those that are incarcerated, the law-abiding, the DOC employees, current and future CFP participants, a more authentic engagement about this budgetary shortfall, and we need to have engagement about the budgetary process the real way that it's meant to happen. And pulling the rug out from under people's feet like this, including all of the CFP participants and all of the families that are engaged as employees in the DOC, it's not acceptable. It's not a lot to ask. We just want the right amount of time allotted so that there can be healthy, wise, thoughtful decisions made. This is no small task to fix the budget deficit, and shouldering it on the back of the only best performing program in the entire DOC, and shouldering it entirely on that, and shouldering it on the families and the dedicated employees of the DOC is unthinkable. It's asinine. Every person in the state of Minnesota has a stake in this. This is not just a Northeast Minnesota issue. This is about the futures of all kids and all families and all parents that are at home solo parenting while their loved one is incarcerated. This affects old people, young people, everybody. So if we want to have true public health and, public safety, we need to at least, at minimum, maintain CIP at Willow River and Togo as is, and it would actually be wise to expand the programs because, as many of you know, the bed shortage at CIP, or in the DOC, is usually about 200-some beds, and those guys that don't have a spot at the Minnesota prison sit in another cell in county somewhere and just rot with zero programming. And so that is not that is not criminal justice reform, and that does nothing to forward the health of the state in terms of community and safety and all that kind of stuff. So this is a huge public safety concern. This is a huge child welfare concern. The closing of Pogo and Willow River. And as people have said, it can't happen anywhere else. And as people have expressed, there's a unique special sauce up here in northern Minnesota that cannot be experienced anywhere else. The dedicated staff and the contact are the major things that allow CIP to be successful. And I just implore you to do the things that need to be done such that we can have authentic engagement and do this directly through the budgetary process that's coming up in January through spring, is it? Or, yeah. So that's my very honest but not polished statement. Personally, I have a spouse that works for the Department of Corrections at Togo, and we too are not locals. We moved here 8 years ago to participate in what was then the MCF Disability Boys Program. I should be concerned about the fact that we have three children that all have rare medical conditions, and we traveled to Philadelphia, New York, Minneapolis, and Duluth, and Fargo on a regular basis to get care, and it would be crazy to have my husband, who's a dedicated employee, just to have his benefits just be taken away all of a sudden. It's ridiculous. So there's no need for it. There's every reason that we should have the correct due process for examining this and have an authentic engagement and let's do the process right and figure out how to handle and take care of the budget deficit. And it should not be shouldered on Northeast Minnesota. The dedicated employees of the DOC, including the cooks, including the TV council staff, including the corrections officers, including everyone. And it should not be shouldered on the small communities that are here already suffering. I'm sure there's a lot more that I wish I will have said after I log off with you guys, but thank you for listening. And as you can imagine, we are not in favor of the closure of Willow River or Togo, mostly for the concern of public safety in general and the greater good of Minnesota. As the court systems open up and get going back at full tick again, there's going to be a bed shortage, and it is not helpful to have people sitting in county jail and rotting. That is not criminal justice reform. Also, how about the thousands, $30,000 or more dollars that will not be going to the school land trust revenue for all the campgrounds that will be closed up here because the DNR has no longer maintained those campgrounds. There's about 8 or 10 campgrounds for at least the last 5 years, and it has been squarely on the shoulders of CIP volunteer labor through the CIP guys that we work through. And so all those campgrounds, most of those campgrounds, except one, are all, the revenues generated at those campgrounds are all through, all that money generated goes to the school district. And so the school district is going to lose at least $30,000 in revenue if CIP at Togo goes away and those campgrounds are closed. Also, there's a security issue bringing back the public safety. If those campgrounds are closed because they're not able to be maintained or monitored, then there's going to be a huge security issue because there's a huge, it's like Alaska. There's like a huge landmass, and we're not going to have the law enforcement to make sure that four-wheelers and folks aren't hiking in or four-wheeling in and using those campsites. So those campsites are going to get trashed. There's going to be illegal activity there, and there's a whole other set of problems that will happen special and connected to CIP going away at Togo and over Willow River. So those are just a couple of the things that we've touched on briefly, and that's my statement, and I'm not good with celebrity. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you for actually a quite eloquent testimony and sharing of your reality and filling in a few more dimensions than what we typically would think about, you know, in terms of the interconnectedness of the community up there. I also want to acknowledge the sacrifice you and your husband have made as a public servant. That is the mark of public servants across the state of Minnesota. And so it's vitally important that we get the process right. And so I think your request is a fair request in terms of making budgetary decisions, you know, through a different process. That is what we tried to do last year when we passed this budget in full, the House's budget request in full public participation, and then moved it, you know, off the floor of the House. Unfortunately, that did not happen in the other body. You know, these are not the kind of outcomes that any one of us, I would dare say, who's a legislator, want. But they are the kind of outcomes that can happen when we don't follow those processes. So I think your both admonition and request is absolutely appropriate. But thank you for sharing your story and your insights on the impact of this work in the state of Minnesota. We have Terry Sullivan, retired captain and member of the public, as well. Captain Sullivan.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Mr. Chair and the members. I have 32 years of experience working at MCF Togo. Hopefully my time there lends credibility to my comments. During my time at Togo, I've witnessed life-altering changes in the clients who have gone through the program. The number of testimonials I have heard from individuals are countless. As a past director of CIP, I've also been a part of in-depth, measurable research of best practice in corrections. Testimonials, research, and personal experience has proven to me beyond a doubt the success of this program is a result of the program components, the location, and the dedicated staff. All three of these elements work together to bring out the best in the other. Separating these pieces will result in a negative impact on recidivism of these men. When I started in corrections, we were looked at nationwide as a leader. One of the reasons for that was the creation of innovative programs such as CIP. If this program is not funded or is cut, it will be a huge step in the wrong direction. The savings to the taxpayers is a verifiable amount. I really compare this decision to not spending $10 on caulking for your windows when you know over time it will save much more and reduce heating costs. The commissioner is focused on the here and now, which he probably has to be, but please don't allow a quick fix to the budget that we all pay for years to follow. And just one more comment about, you know, I respect government. I worked within the government my entire career, but you know, really, the commissioner is blaming the Republican leadership for not passing the bill. The Republican leadership is blaming the governor. And really, the governor has said it, you know, what places cuts need to be made are the responsibility of the commissioner. So we have this vicious triangle. And it's very frustrating. You maybe don't feel it as much until you're actually impacted by it, and of course not me as much as the current employees, but it's very frustrating to see how this is going to all work out. And I really hope that, you know, the three entities can come together and make this work out for the better. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Captain Sullivan. I have to say that is a very powerful and simple and correct expectation. And my hope is that by using what we do, which is to have public vetting and hearing and engaging with the public and with one another, that we can move something. And certainly is my intent to move something the next time that we convene so that we can address this issue. I think the challenge to the issue is going to be not only immediate, but it'll be a long-term challenge. But per your colleagues prior, the person who just spoke before you, following a good, transparent process is one way in which we can answer some very difficult questions together. So hopefully this hearing will help, highlight and accentuate the importance of moving forward in a good process way that takes into consideration more than just the numbers on the page before us. So thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
With that, we have one more person who had signed up to testify, Mr. Will Cooley from Decarcerate Minnesota. Is Mr. Cooley here?
I'm here.
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Will Cooley. I'm a member of Decarcerate Minnesota. I'm also a union member and a son of grandson of union members. First, I'd like to thank with a sincere thank you to Representative Ray Dean. He's been a voice for marginalized populations and a champion of second chances. We look forward to his continued leadership. Decarcerate Minnesota is dedicated to ending mass incarceration. However, blanket cuts to the Department of Corrections budget imperil the safety and well-being of incarcerated people and correctional staffers. For example, when the state of Ohio closed the minimum security facility for cost reasons in 2018, they did not reduce the number of prisoners, but instead crowded them into Marion Correctional. In June, that penitentiary, built for 1,500 inmates, had 2,000 coronavirus cases. Built for 1,500, 2,000 coronavirus cases. COVID calamities behind bars are another indication that mass incarceration is the scourge of our time. It is unfathomable that the land of liberty has the world's largest prison population. Yet here we are. We can do better, and here are three common sense measures to achieve a smaller, smarter criminal justice system. First, our Less is More bill, which was sponsored by Representative Dean, limits detention for technical violations and prevents crime by incentivizing good behavior for people on community supervision. As Commissioner Schnell has stated, warehousing and churn are major challenges facing the DOC. The DOC's own research shows that the warehousing of people creates crime and churn undermines the safety of incarcerated people and guards. We consulted with Joe Brogy from AFSCME to craft this bill. He told us there is no benefit to returning technical release violators to prison, and their presence makes guards' jobs harder. 30 states have passed bills to reform technical violations, while Minnesota lags behind. Secondly, we need to change correctional incentives. Right now, prison is the only option that is free for counties as the state pays for it. This encourages the overuse of prisons and discourages community solutions. The correctional free lunch, as it's called, drives mass incarceration as prosecutors and judges can be tough on crime with any direct fiscal consequences. The disparities among Minnesota counties are striking. I wish Representative Nash was here because I would talk about Carver County. Carver County is a model for diverting people from prison. At 73 per 100,000 residents, Carver has one of the lowest incarceration rates in the nation. But are his constituents rewarded for being smart on crime and being responsible stewards of taxpayer money? They are not. Instead, they're subsidizing other counties such as Monoman, which is sending people to prison at a rate 23 times higher than Carver County, or Mille Lacs County, which is 10 times higher than Carver. Are these places exponentially more dangerous than Carver County? Carver County should be rewarded with funding for diversion, treatment, and crime prevention programs. Likewise, counties that are overusing prison space should have skin in the game to discourage the incarceration of people who can and should be rehabilitated locally. A red state, Ohio, and a blue state, California, have undertaken these reforms. We can too. I'd like to mention too, Representative O'Neill, I know you care a great deal about diverting people from prison. Wright County, where you're from, has a very low incarceration rate. Why are you subsidizing other counties overusing prisons? Thirdly, we need bail reform. We need to make smart use of jail space. Several people have pointed out that we have people boarding in jails right now, rotting away in these cells. That's not smart use. Bail is also not a smart use of our precious space. Selling people based on their ability to pay bail makes no sense and undermines the legitimacy of our criminal justice system. Given recent events, this committee needs to be laser focused on ending mass incarceration and restoring legitimacy. To operate successfully, the legal system must have the trust and support of the citizens it regulates. Can anyone here argue that this is the case today? Much of human behavior can be explained by the proper incentives. When we incentivize the right things, education, work, and family, good things tend to happen. Right now, our criminal justice system incentivizes the wrong things, such as the overuse of prison and the warehousing of inmates, and fails to incentivize the positive things like good behavior and humane community-based solutions. The signs were flashing red before 2020, and now we're dealing with the fallout of ignoring them. Let's make 2021 the year that Minnesota gets serious about substantial changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooley. Thank you for the work of the Decarcerate. I hear some similar themes, particularly as I listen to the Togo Willow River staffers and program folks here. And I do think that there is this incredible wisdom about, you talked about in terms of blanket cuts, is not wise. You pointed to places where that has borne out horribly. And yet our process this year has gotten us to this point. And my hope is that we can get back to a much more deliberate, steady, consistent decision around how we keep our commitment to public safety and corrections, and that we do it with this reform thinking, which I think was pretty strongly captured by a number of the Togo personnel. That wraps up the people I have that signed up to testify. There is a long list of questioners from the committee, and so I want to go through that. I did promise Representative Poston that he would be first on that list, and so I'm going to call on Representative Poston at this time.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I have a few questions for Commissioner Schnell, if he's still with us.
I believe he is.
The first question I have is, back during session in one of our corrections subcommittee meetings, we talked about how many people your agency was short. Can you update us on that number?
Yes. At present, Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, we have 47 vacancies. We anticipate that since the settlement of the contract, that we have high numbers of people applying, and the vacancies right now are we're holding vacancies at Rush City, pending the and most pending the outcomes of this closure decision. But even right now, Stillwater, which had a big gap, right now Faribault is one of the facilities that has some challenges, but we anticipate that. We're seeing the number of applicants, and so we do not anticipate that within the next 2 months that we would have any vacancies at all in the officer ring.
Thank you, Commissioner. You know, the reason that I'm – thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I'm asking that question and this next question is I'm looking at your inmate census right now, and I'm looking at a significantly lower census than in January of 19. Your census was at almost 10,000, and now you're at 7,500 ish, and you've been running understaffed for quite a period of time. So I'm kind of struggling with those two numbers to understand why we're having such a hard time with our budget, because our budget was based on a higher census and more employees. So I'm struggling with closing these two seemingly really good programs to fix a budget that maybe we shouldn't be having a budget problem with. So I'm going to ask you that question. But then I'd also like your thoughts on what was said earlier. We had someone that said we were buying new desks, we were hiring new managers, we were adding to the upper tier, if you will. So if you could kind of
take all that and answer it, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Mariani, Representative Poston, happily. I think, first of all, let me just say that census-wise, you're right. I think even right around March 1st, I think we had around 8,800 or 8,900 people in prison. And since then, we're now at, as you point out, about 7,550 thereabouts. A big chunk of that is the fact that on a regular basis, the DOC releases about 600 people per month. That's just standard, regular, everyday releases. As you know, we've done some releasing, early release programming related to COVID, but a very small number across in our state, about 250. The biggest reason for our drop has been the courts not functioning, so we're not seeing the number of commitments come in. And we've had some conversations with the state court administrator's office that we there's an additional backlog of about between 6,000 and 7,000 felony-level cases. The problem, we talk about savings, why haven't we seen the savings then because of our population reduction? The challenge really is that unlike some places where you don't hire, we've talked about this in committee, we really are filling posts, security posts. And so when you operate in posts, whether we're at Stillwater right now, whether we're double bunked or whether we're single bunked in a housing unit, it still takes X number of staff on a 24/7 basis to operate that housing unit. Now, we're operating it at single bunk largely because of trying to manage the spread of COVID, and is a testament to, I think, the staff across the DOC. They've done a phenomenal job of managing it compared to many other states around the country. We have had our challenges, and we continue to face those challenges, but we're doing quite well, and I think it's a testament to them. So the reason you aren't seeing it is simply, the big reductions is unless we start to pack people in closer and close or shut down posts, which has implications then from a COVID standpoint, we don't realize the savings because of that. And then as to the search, have we added the Office of Professional Accountability? Yes. I think as you recall, when we had the conversation with the Office of Legislative Auditor, one of the major concerns that was raised was issues around sexual harassment and sexual abuse of staff and misconduct and cultural issues that have been pervasive. And the fact that the DOC itself has had historically been the highest number of complaints around sexual harassment related complaints of any other agency in state enterprise. And we said when I testified before all of you related to the OLA report, that we were committed to making a difference around this. We've demonstrated that by making investments. And I would say we plan for the funding of some of that by doing, at the beginning of the fiscal year, we did a holdback of 1.5% in different units across the DOC, saved about $14 million over the biennium. The goal of that was to cover the cost of some of those initiatives, number one. And two, importantly, was to plan and prepare for the fact that, if we didn't do that, the cost or our supplemental budget request would be that much higher because of the settlement of the contracts. And so we wanted to make sure that we were planning on trying to have be able to at least cover some of that. And those costs of the additions to staffing, I'm happy to talk more about it. You can look at the tribal liaison, and you can simply look at what happens with the tribal people in our system. We have struggled there, and we need to have much deeper engagement with tribal communities around that. So I can address whatever questions you may have specifically about that. The TVs that were talked about, really that is ITV investments that the state has made for communications really across the state. The courts are doing it. The DOC has done that. And so the ITV investments are really part of minute investments that we're seeing go up across the state and state enterprise.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Paulston. I'm going to move over to the chair of our Corrections Committee, Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Would like to correct one thing that I heard earlier that was incorrect. The ombudsman position was budgeted for, I believe it was $1.8 million last year. That was not an unfunded mandate. As far as some, and I'd like to also talk just for a second about the process for the budget. We were ready to vote on the deficiency budget and the supplemental budget at the in May. We were again ready to vote on it in June, and then in July we did pass it. And all during that time period, I'm going to have to just get off here for just a second. I got a little emergency with 3-year-olds.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Very wise. Very wise man. Well, let's move on to Representative Johnson. I'll come back to Chair Considine.
Chair Mariani, members, first of all, I want to thank the testifiers that we had today, especially the corrections officer and the staff at Willow River and Togo. They enlightened a lot of people very much on the wonderful programs that are up there, programs that actually work, programs that actually save the state money in the long run, programs that help their communities. That with these programs being shut down are going to devastate the communities. Now, I know we have programs in our system that don't work, that have never worked, and we're still funding them, but they're not even being looked at to be shutting down. Keeping programs that don't work and shutting down programs that do work, that have a good success rate, that's a recipe for a 100% failure. Now, these programs up in Togo and Willow River, yeah, they're a little more expensive. But we heard what those programs do. They do a lot of things for their communities. Look at up in Itasca County where Togo is. Almost 40% of the land up there is government-owned. Whether it's the county, whether it's the state, whether it's the federal government, whether it's the school district, they don't pay any taxes. And I was looking at the numbers. With that much land, they don't get a lot of PILT payment on top of that. So it's everybody else that has the burden to fix and take care of the roads in those communities where there's nobody paying the taxes. Now, the men up in the Challenge Incarceration Program up there, they do a lot for that community. They take pride in their work. And that's something that helps them get over this so they don't commit crimes again. They have pride in themselves because they earned it. That's something that's not granted. You have to earn that pride and that respect. Now, and I also look at, they talked about moving it to a building outside the wire, right next to the facility. Now, I know how that program works. I've actually been to Togo before it was when it was still the juvenile program. It works great. And it's because they're taken out of the prison system and into a different area and away from the things that have been destructive in their lives. Putting it back with that wire standing next to them, it's not going to work. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of time. We need to keep the programs the way they are. We need to look at other places to find the funds to make up this this shortfall. And it's a huge shortfall. It's 2.5, which is more just for this biennium, or this year, the biennium, which is more than what we have in our reserves. And it's going to be close, right now, the projection in February is close to $4 billion shortfall this next biennium that we have to figure out how we're going to pay for and how we're going to cover that. We're going to have to make those cuts. I remember back in the Pawlenty administration, there was a study done, and they found out that the Department of Corrections was way top-heavy on administrative. I'm looking at the flow chart of the right now, and I see that same problem. One of the testifiers mentioned that they were hiring new captains and lieutenants and upper management instead of the corrections officers. We need to look at that, make sure that we're not top-heavy, that we have people where they need to be, and to make sure that the positions are filled and covered, that we need to have. I'm looking at the numbers from January 23rd to 2019 to now. It's a 23.5% reduction in inmates. 23.5% from just shy of 10,000 to barely 7,500. That's almost 25% reduction. 25% reduction in staff or in inmates. And we have a shortfall like that. I'm in business as well. I understand how wages and how staff work. For every dollar that is in salary, on the backside, there's about $1.15 to $1.20 that goes on top of that the employees don't know about for every full-time employee. When you pay overtime, you're not paying that extra $1.25. You're only paying about 70 to 80 cents of that. Now, we've been running short staff for 2 years. We fully budgeted for the employees, including new employees. Remember, I had 50-plus new employee corrections officers. And we've never been full staff. At times, we were well over 100 short and paying overtime. Like I said, overtime is less expensive than a full-time employee. It's hard on the employees if it gets too much, but it's still cheaper than full-time employees. I'd really like to know how we got this huge deficit when we haven't had full staff and how that's going to happen, because we have a huge deficit we're going to have to deal with next year. And we need to get this economy opened up so it's not as bad, but it's still going to be ugly that we're going to have to deal with. And Commissioner Schnell is going to have to deal with and figure out how he's going to do this and still have the results that we should have. Like I say, maybe we need to relook at that study under the Department of Corrections administrative side of things under the Pawlenty administration when it was top heavy, and maybe we make sure that we're not top heavy now wasting money. And thank you. And Commissioner, I do hope that you change your mind, because those programs are not only good for the inmates, it's also good for the communities. And it's going to cost those communities more than what you're trying to save by shutting them down. Thank you.
I don't know if you wish to comment, Commissioner. You don't have to.
Thank you, Chair. I would just say, Representative Johnson, I appreciate that. You know, the challenge really becomes, so we know that there's really good data about CIP, and trust me, I'm not arguing that. I never have, and I'm supportive. We were there. The challenge is you start looking at it in our system, cutting things like treatment and all of those things are really not solid propositions, and you know, we simply can't do that. Health services, as you know, is really about $90 million a year just in health services, constitutionally required. Now we're looking at all these different options, including, you know, cutting layers and looking at and making, assessing, are there more efficient ways to do things? Because I think one of the things that happens when you have budget crises like this is it does force you to look, and we should always be doing that. And I think it's a good thing. At the same time, I want to be clear that we want CIP to continue. I would just say one thing I appreciate, and there is no doubt, meeting the staff up there and being in Togo and Willow River, it's an incredible feeling. And the cultures there are incredible. I've said this to the staff. I would just say that while it's intuitive that part of the environment is actually results in some of the outcomes, when I went to our research folks and just said, how much is there a correlation? And the evidence does not bear out that necessarily there is a correlation. That said, there is no doubt that the committed staff there make all the difference in the world. And certainly the pastoral feel makes a huge difference. And the men talked about that when I was there. So I don't want to minimize that. We were simply, by proposing the Moose Lake option, was a way of trying to maintain a commitment to the program. And as I said, the best of a range of bad options.
Well, and let me just say very quickly before I move back to Chair Considine that it is my intent, assuming that we're back in session soon, to give everyone in this committee a second, third chance to vote for supplemental and deficiency funding. Representative Johnson, I'm going to give you another chance to do that. A number of us on this committee, including you, did not do that last year. So it's one thing to say that it's a great program. We really appreciate what they're doing. It's another thing to make sure that they're funded to do their work. And so I'm really looking forward to coming back. Hopefully we will. This bill will be before us, and we'll be able to exercise our will, based on our voting. Representative Chair Considine, back to you. Hopefully you've got your three-year-old issue.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, actually, they just got here. This meeting was supposed to be over an hour and 15 minutes ago. And one was getting ready to slam the other one's fingers in the door. So I apologize to everybody for having to jump off there. As I was saying, we were ready to vote on this in May. We were again in June. July, the House passed it. And as Chair Mariani just mentioned, there are several on this call that did not vote for it then. But the primary obstacle, of course, was the Senate not passing it. We wouldn't be having this discussion. We would not be having this meeting had the Senate taken up the bill and passed it. They didn't even take it up. They didn't debate it even. So, that's where we really had fallen down as a legislature. I would really like to hear sometime, well, probably offline, what programs that Jared Johnson is thinking we can cut. Treatment, education, the single biggest thing for recidivism is a level in education. We can't cut health services, vocational training. I would like to know what these mythical programs are. Because there, quite frankly, aren't any there that I don't see having some real value with. And I think they've been weeded out over the years. Personally, I'm a little concerned about adult basic education at this point. My understanding is that a number of the managers have been let go. And that would be, again, literature's real clear. The single biggest indicator of recidivism is a rise in a level of education. So there are, I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about when that we're coming to that thing. But, and I did make the point about the Office of Ombudsman was actually fully funded ahead of time. So, sorry, I'm a little frazzled trying to get the twins in to a position where they're safe. And actually my sister is taking care of that. I'll come back if I want to make some more points, but I got to be honest right now. I'm just a little bit frazzled.
Yes, indeed. Representative Christensen.
Uh, Thank you, everyone. I'll be really quick. I realize we're really overdue, but I agree with Carlo. Thank you, Mr. Chair, by the way. And thank you to all the testifiers. And I enjoyed hearing from the folks up at Togo, and I know how incredibly important the mental health services, the addiction services that are happening up there, what that means to to our folks that are incarcerated. So thank you to them. That's they are angels for doing that, because the results that they get, I have no doubt, are fabulous. So anyway, I just want to say that I support funding what we can fund right now. I want to thank everyone, all the testifiers, for testifying. And, I learned a lot today. I think many of the testifiers we've heard before. And so I apologize to them that this sort of keeps coming up and coming up. But maybe this is the time that we can get it all the way through and everyone will vote it through. So thanks to everyone. And thanks, especially the folks up at Togo, for what you do up there. Thank you.
Indeed. Representative O'Neill. You might be muted or going in and out. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear you. Oh, you got some distortion going on, Representative O'Neill. Let's hang in there a few seconds and maybe I'll just come back.
Now.
Sort of. Keep trying.
Welcome to Greater Minnesota.
Yes, indeed. Oh my God, I can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me now. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair. I turned a couple things off to see if that helps. So not all cuts are equal, and I also would oppose these cuts to Togo and to Willow River. And something that has not been said yet is the impact in the area of Moose Lake and Willow River, because something that may not be widely known yet is that DHS is also going to be cutting the sex offender program within Moose Lake Prison. So that will negatively impact this area yet again. So not only will Willow River close, but also the sex offender program at Moose Lake is scheduled to close. Now, I don't mean the civil commitment, but the program within the prison, just to be clear. I don't think that we could constitutionally close the civil commit of the sex offender program at MSOP. But I do mean the sex offender program within Moose Lake. So that's going to be a tremendous impact on one small part of Minnesota. And just as you heard from Togo and the incredible impact in that community, this is going to be a double whammy to the impact of Moose Lake and Willow River. And for those that haven't actually toured all of the state prisons as I have, what makes both Togo and Willow River so incredibly interesting and impactful is there are literally no fences. So you've got a program that is very intense. It's like boot camp, I guess. And there literally are no wires, which is why they keep saying that they're outside of the wire. And I understand that Commissioner had said that there's not a statistical significance, the difference between the two programs, but it is a very different way to do the program, and it's a very successful program. So another thing that the commissioner had said that's very important to reiterate is that they had to cover the costs of the contract settlements. So as you recall, we were going through session and the House ratified the contracts. The Senate did not ratify the contracts. But that has been incredibly impactful on the budget for all of the agencies and incredibly impactful, particularly for the DOC. And I cannot see all of the numbers, all of the increase specifically for the DOC. I can only see for the corrections officers. But I do know that that number alone is over $17 million. So we know that just the new contract being implemented without being ratified by the Senate has impacted the DOC budget over $17 million. So that's kind of the elephant in the room of why are we here? That's why we're here. The other impact that was very hard on them, not as large as the settlements, but when Officer Gom was horribly murdered, the MinCorp program shut down. They have very slowly started to creep open, but that impact, that fiscal impact, you know, again, they are a revenue generating arm of the DOC, and they lost quite a bit of revenue. So that also negatively impacted their budget. So I would urge the commissioner to look at other places to cut, whether it's at the administrative level in the central office. I've heard multiple complaints from corrections officers that they are heavy on administration, that they're buying brand new vehicles for administration and for the central office folks. And I'm not sure where all it's going, but there is great concern that there's way too much being spent above their head, so to speak. So I would urge the commissioner to take a closer look at that. The other problem is, as been stated before, we are in a budget deficit. We are no longer just in a $2.4 billion budget deficit for the state, but we are actually over $4 billion as the new numbers have come out. So I'm not quite sure where we're going to get the money to supply any of the money that we were talking about today, because we simply don't have it. So unless we cut somewhere else, there is no money, because we are a balanced budget state. We are legally bound to balance budget. So I don't see in this this bill that we have before us that there's a place where you actually are cutting somewhere else. Now, maybe you'll need to talk to some of your other chairs from other committees that they'll have to cut, but quite frankly, every committee area will probably have to cut in order to balance the budget again moving forward. So my one question to the commissioner, I've asked this before, I hadn't gotten an answer, and I'm going to reiterate the question, is I want to know what the total contract costs, the settlement costs were. I only can see for the corrections officers and cells. And again, that was $17 million that just settled. So the commissioner could let us know what is the totality of the DOC cost for settlement of the contracts.
Chair Mariani, Representative O'Neill, we're just doing some quick calculation here, but we have a sheet that's got them.
So
we think it's some, you know, I will get you to the dollar, but we believe this contract settlement is somewhere in the vicinity of about $23 million.
So if you include pattern and correctional,
that would be the $29 million if you include pattern and correctional officers. So the pattern across the enterprise, and then the additional dollars that were invested in the correctional officer contract, which was really to make us more competitive, and to so that we could fill those positions, $29 million.
Let me come back to this and to you, Representative O'Neill, if you want to follow up. I just want to very quickly, I've just been told that Representative Dean needs to leave, and this very, very well may be the last public safety criminal justice reform hearing that he sits in. And so I want to make sure that I honor my colleague, Representative Dean, in lots of different ways, including calling on him at this moment. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief. I mean, we're in this unusual situation, and the commissioner's in an untenable situation because of our inability to fund corrections at the level that it needs to be. We can talk about the reduction in population and all those things, and as someone who's actually studied a lot about the impacts of reductions of populations, the savings to corrections departments really occurs when you close a facility. That's really where the substantial savings takes place. You do reduce a little bit of labor costs by reducing population, but ultimately the significant savings are when you close facilities. You know, we all know that we're in this situation not because of anything that any of us did, anything the commissioner did. You know, this is directly the result of this pandemic and the impact it has. The cost of confinement relative to residents getting COVID is incredibly huge, incredibly a dangerous situation. And we found hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to try to address those issues outside of the facilities. And when I say that, I'm talking about the hundreds of million dollars that we found, albeit some of it was from the federal government, to address the issues of our healthcare system, the hundreds of millions of dollars that we've found and been able to allocate for employees that found themselves out of work, hundreds and millions of dollars that we found for businesses to try to keep them afloat. And so we have the money. We can get the money. I'm very troubled that all we're talking about is cutting budgets when we know that the top 5% people across our country and our state are incredibly wealthy and are incredibly gaining more wealth through these really, really difficult times. So I will just not accept that this is an issue of deficiencies. This seems like more of an issue of perspective and what we want to do. I think we really need to get serious about this. And if that means that, you know, my Republican colleagues in the House saying you're absolutely right, we need to make sure these things are funded so we don't close Togo, so we don't close Willow River and all those other things to deal with the added costs of what we've seen over the past several months. Please do that. And please contact your counterparts and your colleagues in the Senate, because this needs to happen. I've been sitting on this call for, you know, 3 hours, like pulling my hair out, saying, I can't believe that this is the only way we're looking at resolving this situation. We put a commissioner and folks in an untenable situation. And, you know, the solution isn't to open up Minnesota. I mean, let's face it. The moment we do that, we're going to see a huge, huge spike of not just the general public and the number of cases of COVID. We're also going to see the huge spike on the inside, which is going to put the commissioner and our corrections officers and staff in really, really difficult situations. So I actually entered this call and with one question that I think is pertinent, and I'd like the commissioner to answer that. And short of that, I will go, because I have to actually have a doctor's appointment at 4 o'clock. Commissioner, what is going to happen to the issue of ratios of staff to residents through your current proposal to address the budget shortfall that you find yourself in? Will those ratios go up? Will those ratios go down? Or will those ratios be somewhat maintained at the level that they're at? And thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me jump in here.
Of course, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the staffing, by cutting the facilities, as you point out, that's where the savings ultimately is realized. And what it does is it allows you to maintain fuller staffing in the remaining facilities. So in the best case scenario, what a cut could do, what the closure cuts do, is they maintain staffing levels at the remaining facilities at equally high levels. So when they're fully staffed, we should have full staff complements in those facilities with no cuts in services there. And so that's the challenge of if you cut across the board, you impact everything, everyone. If you cut more strategically and cut facilities, again, bad, not good choices. Ultimately, it allows you to maintain fuller staffing at the rest of the facilities.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dean. Hopefully we will be in special, and I'll get to see you again in this committee in discussion, as well as my good friend and colleague, Chair Lesh. Representative Long, I've got you as our last question. And then we do have one other colleague who's not on the committee that wishes to testify. We'll close out with her testimony. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I think that we're facing a short-term budget problem, and we're facing a longer-term budget question. And the short-term budget problem we've known about since the spring, and we've known the answer since the spring, which is that we need to pass the supplemental budget to get us through the next year for the corrections department. And that's the answer that we have been trying to get done for many months. And I, you know, some folks have raised the longer term budget questions, which are legitimate, but I think we need to get ourselves to a point where we know what those budget questions are and where we can make decisions in the full context of knowing what the budget decisions are, knowing what different agencies' balances may be, and not having to force these cuts on particular agencies because of shortfalls that are caused through the pandemic. And the Department of Corrections has already taken a big cut with the 45-person layoffs. They're being the first mover, you know, in making these decisions. But when we look at the scope of the entire budget next year, that may not be where we decide we want to balance the budget. So I think it is extremely important that we give ourselves, the legislature, the space to get to next year, to be able to have the fullness of the budget conversation and not shortchange the administration and particularly the Department of Corrections in the middle of a pandemic. And so I just wanted to ask the commissioner if he might reflect on the difference between the short-term budget needs that are being forced on you right now and having the longer term budget conversation in the context of the full state budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, thank you for that question. I think we, you know, we want to get through this year. I think we want to we need to get through this battle. We know that there are challenges, and you all need to make tough decisions going forward. But we were committed to that budget request that we made. We would like to see this. I've committed to legislators. I've committed to staff that have asked, you know, can we walk this back for right now? And the answer to that is yes. With the way we've planned this, where we've had to move because ultimately we have to square our budget by the end of this fiscal year. And it takes time to affect all this just from the standpoint of rules, as heartless and cold as that sounds. But the reality is we are in a position where we would hope to have the opportunity to walk this back and then engage in the broader, more robust discussion with all of you in the next budget planning process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lama, and very well put. And I'll reiterate this chair's position that it's certainly my intention to do everything that I can and encourage my colleagues on this committee to make sure that as we enter what no doubt will be painful discussions next year generally, that public safety and corrections be part of that conversation in a strong position. I would expect nothing less of any other chair and any other committee as well. And that's especially true given that this committee, in its wisdom, I believe, moved very assertively a few months ago toward that end. And for largely the failure of the other body to act at all, we have not been able to be part of this short-term solution. Members, finishes our testimony and questions. We do have a colleague that has asked to speak. It's certainly, I believe, custom and usage. Certainly been my custom that even though a committee member, or rather a colleague is not a committee member, if an item is before us that is of paramount importance to that individual, particularly as it may impact their direct constituencies, that we afford that person the respect and time to hear their views, advice, and recommendations. And so with that, I want to welcome, as our last testifier here today, Representative Julie Sandstein. Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak very much today. I, too, want to just give a big shout-out to everybody who testified today and say thank you for the words that you shared. They were very powerful. I just want to quickly recap some of the things that we talked about in terms of impact to the region. MCF Togo is in my district. We heard about some of the work that the inmates do. What we didn't hear a lot about was how they volunteer with making habitat homes. And we in Greater Minnesota have a shortage of housing like we do in the rest of the state. We heard a little bit about the work they do with Access North in building ramps and helping to foster independent living, which is a win for anyone in the state of Minnesota. When we talk about the park, the state park reservations and camp reservations, in 2019, there were over 9,000 reservations where people came and stayed, and it's estimated those people visiting and camping brought in over $2 million into a rural economy, which is a huge lifeline. Without the support of the inmates keeping up those campsites, we're going to lose that economy as well. So critical to living in rural Minnesota is the volunteers that really make. We have volunteer firefighters. We don't have paid fire departments to protect our communities out there. Most of these places are volunteer. They are first responders. They are school board members, our community activists. So again, I'm going very quickly through this, but the people that are the employees at Togo are also really the underpinning in the fiber of a rural community. And the next thing I want to talk about is something I really haven't heard today in any of the conversation. And I think it's very important that everybody understands if the jobs are lost or at Togo, they do not have an opportunity to go to another facility. There is contract language that governs this. And the language states that these jobs are only transferable within a 35-mile radius. There is not another facility within 35 miles of Togo. So the job loss at Togo means job loss, not pick up your family and move to another location and buy another house and try to sell your current home. It just means you're without a job. And I think that's a really important piece to understand. It is a difference between the employees at Togo and the employees at Willow River. And the next thing I want to talk about is job loss in Greater Minnesota. This loss or proposed cut really disproportionately impacts Greater Minnesota. It disproportionately impacts our region because a job loss in Greater Minnesota is not the same as a single job loss in a metro or an urban or a suburban area. They are not a one-to-one ratio. Losing a job in Greater Minnesota is on par with losing close to 100 jobs in an urban or suburban community. So this is a really, really big deal. Another thing that I want to say to Commissioner Schnell is I respectfully disagree with you so much about the location having an impact on the outcome of these inmates. I heard it firsthand a year ago when I visited Togo and visited with an inmate who had been through the Department of Corrections for a variety of reasons, 8 or 9 different times, I can't remember. But he told me this was his last time. And when I asked him, why is this your last time? He said, because I've never been to Togo. I've never been here. And it is the quietness and the stillness of the location that allowed the noise in the rest of his life to settle down. And we heard from other testifiers, I think it was Captain Sullivan who talked about maybe having cabins and stuff in this area, like the rest of us understand it. It absolutely has an impact. And as a teacher, I once had a superintendent tell me, class size has no impact on the outcome of your students. And that's ridiculous. If you have 45 kindergartners in a class versus 20 kindergartners in a class, you can guarantee you're going to have a different outcome. And I absolutely believe the same holds true with the location of the Togo facility and the direct correlation to the success of the CIP program. At the rally we had in Nashwauk a few weeks ago, where you were joining us, Commissioner, you mentioned that you wanted to walk it back. And I am asking everybody here that we walk it back. I do understand the financial implications, but this is a penny-wise, pound-foolish decision. There will be money. We will be able to do it. And we really need to carefully weigh the balance of success against the cost. As COVID goes away, as our court systems pick up, I absolutely believe that there's going to be an opportunity for increasing the residents at Togo rather than seeing a decrease. There's going to be an opportunity for job growth, not needing to, you know, lose the facility now. If we lose this facility now, we're not going to have an opportunity to open it up again. With that being said, we absolutely need to pass the bonding bill, and we've heard that. That will help to kickstart our economy across the state. It's also an important piece for all of this. We do have a need for a supplemental budget bill. At the rally in Togo, we heard Democrats and Republicans and everybody coming together and saying, yes, this has to happen. So for the general public listening, you need to contact your legislators, both Democrats, Republicans, House, Senate, and also the governor, and just let them know how important this is. And the expectation of Minnesotans is that we pass a supplemental budget bill and we pass a bonding bill, and we need all parties involved working together on this and getting it done. And with that, I just want to really commend the workers in both of these facilities and the wardens. It is, if you haven't been there, you've missed something. It's a tremendous, tremendous place to see. And the dedication, the heartfelt care and concern and firm boundaries that exist is also part of the success. And this would be a great loss to our state. It's actually a win for our state to keep this open, these programs open. It is a cost savings in the long run. And most importantly, it's you cannot put a price tag on changing and saving lives. And that is what the CIP program in Togo and Willow River is doing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I just say thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. And we'll close out with your comments. And let me just say, I do look forward to us reconvening. I can't believe I'm saying that. I'm looking forward to reconvening in September in the legislature. But, you know, there are important life and death decisions that we have to make, and this is one of them. And we've tried to do that in this committee. We tried back in May. We tried again in July. We will keep trying because it does matter. And let me just say that this last part of this hearing, we talked and heard powerful testimony and powerful discussion on these two facilities. And to kind of steal a metaphor from my committee administrator, in many ways, that discussion is about a system where the light is blinking red. And what's tragic is that it doesn't need to be blinking red. I thought Representative Long did a good job of describing, look, let's take care of the immediate. We could do that. We attempted to do that. And there's no reason why we cannot do that. But the blinking red isn't just these prisons. As vitally important as it is in a correctional system, it also is, and it's why I raised up the other issues for today's hearing, you know, our work around the sexual assault examination kits and the need for justice for victims in our state for sexual assault, where it's just way too easy for folks to get away with wrongdoing simply because we're not responsibly managing these examination kits. That's a system blinking red if we're not funding that. Our crime labs, we heard from our superintendent about the increase in Part 1 crimes, how they're struggling to turn around that evidence. in a responsible period of time. They're not able to do that. That's part of the deficiency funding. The county-based community services work without on-the-ground real redemptive probation work happening, we're only going to make it impossible, difficult to break the cycle of crime that helps our communities. That was part of that funding as well. And so there's a lot of pieces here that just simply need to be taken care of. It's my intent that we, when we come together, that we do that. And I would fully expect after this conversation that every single member of this committee will be supporting that effort going forward. So I want to thank you, all members, for, I know this was a long hearing, but it was important for us to hear from the good folks up north and to have a strong vetting of the funding challenges and opportunities that lie before us. So with that, members, hopefully I'll be convening us all together inside of a couple of weeks. But until then, this committee stands adjourned.